We do not have a quorum yet, but we're going to start the testimony, and people have the agenda, so you know pretty much where you are. And first is Jane Okramowitz. If she's here. Where is she? Oh, okay. She's parking her car, so we'll go to Rick Varco from SEIU. Welcome to the committee, and if you would state your name for the tape.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Varco. I'm the political director for SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. We represent about 17,000 healthcare workers around the state of Minnesota, including about 3,000 nursing home workers, also all over, spread all over the state, both metro and greater Minnesota. I'm here on behalf of the Seniors and Workers Coalition, which is a broad coalition of groups representing folks who work in long-term care and folks who receive those benefits. I will keep my testimony brief. I know you've got a long agenda. Having looked over the bill as much as we can, we are here to oppose the 3% cut in reimbursement rates to nursing homes. I would have preferred to have a worker here to testify about the impact of those cuts, but obviously it's hard to get them off because they're working. But I will highlight an important YouTube video clip you're going to see being released today by the Invest in Minnesota Coalition. It features Emma Woodard, a member of ours at the Providence Place Nursing Home here in the metro area, and she talks very directly and very candidly about the potential impact of nursing home cuts. And I really, having spoken to most of the members of the committee, I think everyone understands the terrible damage that a 3% cut will do to our nursing home industry. So I just want to conclude with sort of two thoughts. First of all, having talked to our members and the business reps who negotiate nursing home contracts, I can assure you there is little to no fat left in nursing home budgets. They have been skimping and scraping for the last 6 years. Nursing homes are one of the most efficient services state government provides. Every dollar you spend on nursing homes provides a dollar or more of care. In addition, we believe nursing homes are something the people of Minnesota believe in, support, and are willing to pay for. So if at the end of the day, when you look at the rest of the budget and the revenue situation, you can't find any alternative other than to cut nursing homes by 3%, we believe you need to look at, and the people of Minnesota will support, raising additional revenues to pay for nursing home funding. Thank you.
Mr. Varco, but you know, our bill does not have a 3% cut for nursing homes. It's the governor's bill that did that. We have a 3% cut for long-term care facilities, but not for nursing homes.
Not, Mr. Chair. I think the governor didn't cut nursing homes either. I think
you're right.
I think we both agree that's a bad idea.
Then I've been misinformed. Okay.
You could. I'm not real pleased with the 3% cut to long-term care facilities, because basically you have the same kind of employees doing the same work. But we did not cut nursing homes.
Mr. Chair,
again,
probably a good feat.
Probably a good feat for the Senate when you get over there to give them that talk. So, thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Varco, and okay. Now Ms. Okramowitz is here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and budget division members. My name is Jane Okramowitz, and I am a volunteer with the Alzheimer's Association Minnesota North Dakota chapter, and was a consumer of long-term care services for my mother, who was in a nursing home for 8 years. She died of complications of Alzheimer's disease in June 2005. I became an advocate for vulnerable adults because of the journey her condition made us share. Our Seniors and Workers for Quality Coalition says that we must assure safety in order to prevent harm for our frail, vulnerable, and uninsurable citizens. Personally, I do not see how the decrease in continuing care payments will benefit any of our citizens, and it surely will not improve their quality of life. In the brief time that we've had to review House File 1362, it appears that the reductions in long-term care and support initially targeted in the governor's budget are sustained in the House position, and that is disappointing beyond words. Staffing in long-term care facilities and services is already stretched to the limit. We talk about nursing homes for the future and consumer-directed care, but these concepts are meaningless without workers to provide the care. We can talk and talk, but with these cuts, we are heading for a workforce of part-time, short-term, and poorly supported aides who are forced by circumstances to work at breakneck speed with highly dependent people, and it's a recipe for tragedy. I know there is not one member of this division who wants to cut payments to the services that are the lifelines for vulnerable adults. And I also know that you've listened to our concerns and the predictions many times already this session. I know, however, that I must come here today as a caring critic and call on you to reject the cuts. They do not have to be inevitable, and there is still time. I would like to address the point that you just said, Mr. Chair, and that is our coalition does not just represent those workers in nursing homes and those long-term care facilities, but we also represent the home and community-based services. And if that's what we're moving towards, more home and community-based services, then this does not help us in that regard. I thank you for listening to my concern.
Thank you. Next, we have Toby Pearson.
Mr. Chair, members, I think we're going to testify as the long-term care imperative altogether. My name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers Minnesota. First, I'd like to just start off by saying we recognize that there's a lot of pain that's created by this bill, that you had a very difficult job, that it probably wasn't a lot of fun trying to put it together. We'd also like to thank you for a couple things. The first thing being not eliminating the dental, podiatry, and rehab services. Those would have created unfunded mandates. We still would have had to provide those services, but with your proposal, we actually continue to get reimbursed for providing those. So we thank you for that. We'd also like to say thank you for suspending rebasing rather than repealing it. We think that that's essential for the long-term planning of long-term care facilities. To see that that language stays in place for the long term so that they can do their financial planning accordingly. We still do have some questions, and I think Jeff's going to touch on these a little bit, about the interplay of the removal of the Medicare influence from nursing facilities. We continue to want to work with both you and the department to try to iron out the discrepancies that seem to appear between what your and the department assumptions are and what some of the reading of it is from some of our members. So we pledge to continue to work with you on that and try to figure out what the problem is there with the reading. Finally, I'd also like to mention that with the single bed election language, since it was first introduced in the governor's proposal, we've been talking to the department regarding some issues with that proposed language. We're waiting to get some clarification from the department that may be needed with that language. As soon as we have that clarification, we'll bring it forward to work with you on possible changes to the language. Just wanted to make you aware of those things as your bill moves forward. Thank you.
Mr. Pearson, I'm well aware that there's a difference of opinion about what the Medicare thing did in nursing home rates, so I'll be happy to work with people to if it comes out the way that that the department's fiscal note is, then it's not nearly as serious as some of your members believe it is.
That's correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Jen McNerney, representing Aging Services of Minnesota and the Long-Term Care Imperative.
I'm here today to talk about the 3% cut to elderly waiver and the 5% additional cut in 24-hour customized living. 24-hour customized living is the MA program that pays for many of the MA recipients in assisted living. The combined 3% and 5% cut equals an 8% cut for some of our providers and the serving some of the most vulnerable elderly in assisted living. We welcome the opportunity to work with the chair and committee members on minimizing this cumulative effect of the 3 and 5%. We realize that this is easier said than done, but we would be happy to continue working with the chair and committee members because Minnesota is an innovator in these areas, and we'd like to continue that. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jeff Bostick with Aging Services in Minnesota. I just want to make a few quick comments on the Medicare piece of the rebasing proposal. And I know we testified to this a couple weeks ago, so I won't belabor the points, but we still have, as Toby said, we have some concerns about the details of how that works. I'd also reiterate that we have some concerns about whether this is something that's necessary to do. And how it will affect the integrity of rebasing as it was proposed a couple of years ago. We understand the financial circumstances the state is facing and the need to delay the implementation of rebasing for a few years as is proposed in the bill. But in the long run, we have concerns about whether the attempt to remove the influence of Medicare revenue from the rates is really a good idea, and what kind of impact that will have on facilities in the long run. So our hope would be if there's a way to implement rebasing without this this Medicare proposal, we would hope to figure out a way to do that. Thanks.
Thank you. John Klein.
Hello,
Mr. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Klein. I'm here on behalf of Prime West Health, which is a county-based purchasing health plan representing 13 counties in western Minnesota, from Pipestone in the south to Beltrami, Clearwater, and Hubbard in the north, and it's headquartered in Douglas County. So thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm here in my capacity as CFO of Prime West. The legislation includes a provision that would add two health plans a premium withhold, which is a performance incentive, a provision about emergency room use that it would have to be reduced by 25% over a period of several years. Prime West has generally done very well over the years with the Department of Human Services performance targets, and we generally have earned all of the targets or very close to all. And so Prime West fully accepts the principle of the performance targets and having withholds from premiums to accomplish that. But this provision regarding emergency room use is not a good fit or priority for rural areas, and for that reason Prime West opposes that provision for several reasons. The first is that emergency room is the only after-hours care that's available to our members in most counties. And as a result, this withhold provision would place health plans that primarily serve rural counties, such as Prime West, at an extreme disadvantage. In most rural counties, including all 13 of ours, the emergency room is the only after-hours source of care. By contrast, in urban centers, patients commonly have far more choices of where to go, such as convenient after-hours care or clinics that have extended evening or weekend hours. The comparatively low volume of rural versus urban ER encounters would also pose a challenge to plans such as Prime West, because even small fluctuations in ER use could have a big impact on our withhold measure. As a result, we think that Prime West could not reasonably expect, despite our best efforts, to earn this withhold measure, especially in the later years as it graduates from 5% initially to 25% reduction over several years. The second reason is there's what's called a layperson standard of defining necessities for emergency room visits. So to meet this target, Prime West would need to reduce members' use
their only source of after-hours care. However, the statutory definition of emergency with the layperson standard is such that it relies on individuals' own perception and judgment about the situation they face. So for us to achieve this standard, we would need to discourage or deny access to the emergency room by either encouraging or forcing members to second-guess their own judgment at the time of an incident about whether they really are in an emergency situation or not, and potentially risk their health as a result. For example, a member may be experiencing a chest pain or side ache. It may be due to a strain, or it may be something more severe. And if it is something more severe, treating a heart condition before an attack, an ER, or appendicitis before a rupture would save money and potentially the health of the members. Again, in our counties, members don't have the option of going to an urgent care clinic that might triage and assess the condition for more severity. And so if the member's own judgment, again, this layperson standard, if they go to the ER, it's likely that their going there would be approved if it was challenged. Third reason is that we have studied ER use, and it's not a major issue based on the data we've reviewed in our area. In rural areas, inappropriate ER use could be considered to occur when a member seeks care in an ER for a non-emergency condition during regular business hours, when a clinic is open, or if a hospital bills inappropriately for something as an emergency when it really is not. And again, our data does not indicate that that appears across our 13-county area. We average less than 100 ER stays in an entire month over the course of a year, so it's not a big volume. Lastly, two factors not unique to rural plans, but plans do have limited ability to influence behavior about emergency room use. Members commonly only are in the plan for a fairly short time, for average enrollment of about 9 months. While education can be applied during that time period, again, if someone is in pain or has a situation they perceive as an emergency, they're likely to go to the ER despite the education. And they're not, it's not something that can be prior authorized by definition. They need to make the decision right then and go. And last but not least, this is a cost-saving incentive. Generally, the withhold measures that are in the DHS contracts are not structured as cost-saving incentives because we already have strong incentives to save costs. We're a capitated health plan. We accept risk, and we're strongly motivated to control costs. And when Prime West saves money in the state's rate-setting methodology, the state also saves money over time as those cost savings are recaptured, and we're constantly looking for ways to do just that. So in summary, we support any reasonable performance incentives that through our best efforts we can meet or exceed, but we oppose incentives such as this one that don't reflect the real environment of rural health care. And we have provided some language to the chair and are hopeful that an accommodation can be reached on this issue. So thanks very much for the opportunity to testify.
Representative Aborn. Thanks, Mr. Klein, for coming. Just a question. Do you have some incidence plots of what time of day people come in after hours? Is it like more in the middle or late evenings, or is it 3 in the morning? And it would be helpful data to me. And do you know offhand? Mr. Klein.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have that data. We do have a number of studies, as I mentioned, that we have done of emergency room use for Prime West members, and I could share that with you. The difficulty of that particular one is that there's not a time stamp in emergency room claims data in the claims as we receive them. So we would have to actually audit the chart to determine the time of day. So what we know is more anecdotal on that point.
Mr. Chair, just as a point.
Representative Board.
And it seems like if everybody's closing at 5, then it's 5:30. I mean, I've had sick kids. You go, well, who's open? And you go wherever. And it strikes me that as we continue to reform our health system, that the concept of doctors working 8 to 5 or whatever, 6 to 5 or whatever, there could be a second shift, you know, and I'm in the industry. And we haven't gone there, but it seems like some of the clinics that are, they've already paid for their bricks and mortar, and this is a thought, and it may actually get at what you're trying to do. If everybody's going before 11, if there's like 8 to 11 is a big time, and there's like 3 at 4 in the morning, then that's a whole different kind of animal. So just a thought, and thanks for coming.
Mr. Klein, you mentioned that your average enrollment is only 9 months. Is that medical assistance or Minnesota Care or both?
That's an average over a 12-month span, Mr. Chair. So generally, GAMC has a lower average enrollment of maybe closer to 6 months. Medical assistance and Minnesota Care would be more like 9, and so they would represent the average. The highest would be the senior programs like Minnesota Senior Care and MSHO, and so they would be close to a year, maybe 11 months on average, and many of those members do stay for multiple years, and so those bring the average up.
Thank you. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Klein, thank you for being here today. One of the questions that I have is I know that many rural hospitals and clinics, being in that situation, but many times they have done something like a urgent care within their emergency room or adjacent to that, and that has been very successful at helping to do that very same thing. Have you researched doing that sort of component in this situation? Have you researched it before? Have you considered that? Because that's been a solution similar to what Representative Abler was talking about.
Mr. Klein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, some of the hospitals in the region do have that kind of option and do bill on that basis, but as an earlier question indicated, sometimes if it's late at night or even in the small hours of the morning, there just isn't the staff to have a second shift and urgent care and an emergency room. Many of the 13 counties in Prime West have under 10,000 citizens in the entire county. One or two may have below 5,000, but that's the entire population, not just the Minnesota Public Programs members. So the challenge many of them face is healthcare access of any kind, attracting doctors, dentists, and keeping hospitals open. So in some of the bigger cities, Bemidji, Alexandria, there are bigger facilities, more healthcare resources, and so the kind of option you described is there. But in some of the smaller counties, it's just not feasible to have that many, slices of availability and staffing throughout the evening, nighttime, and weekend.
Thank you. Okay, next we have Mark McAfee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mark McAfee of AFSCME Council 5. I'd like to thank the chair, the vice chair, the members of the staff, all the members for all the hard work that you put in on these bills. These are very complex, tough issues during a tough economic time. We appreciate that. We also appreciate the questions from the loyal opposition, which keep us all on our toes. Some of the things that we like about this bill, it removes budget-wise the governor's MSOP, SOS pension reform that affects the Corrections Dual Retirement Plan. We appreciate that. Appreciate keeping and expanding fraud prevention investigation in the counties. We appreciate the fact that Anoka Metro RTC and Mito are kept intact. Others will probably speak in greater depth that this bill keeps a lot of folks on health care with the help somewhat of the federal money coming in, but we appreciate that. I know the chair and others have great concern over the hospitals. This bill does mitigate some of the cuts to the hospitals suggested by the governor. But we do face tough choices there. In terms of nursing homes, you don't make cuts. You do delay rather than eliminate nursing home rebasing. But as you all would be aware, of course, just simply not getting COLAs as we cross at least 4-year desert, will be tough on a number of homes. But we appreciate you at least did some mitigation there. We do have some concerns. Perhaps almost the largest one was mentioned by the first two speakers who are part of our Senior and Workers Coalition, of which AFSCME Council 5 is also part. It's a 3% long-term care provider cut. It hits ICFMRs and DTNHs, group homes, et cetera. That's going to be very tough on folks. So that one we have concern about. Finally, I'll mention
that the governor had proposed redesigning county human services, making it mandatory. We remain opposed to the redesign. However, we'll acknowledge that this portion has come a long way. Representative Peason, in working with I know AMC and Max, et cetera, has moved to a voluntary approach. So that looks better to us, but we're still unconvinced that we need to do this at this time. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Members?
Any questions for Mr. McAfee? Well, I'll look for the board.
Thanks, can I ask a question about what's not in the bill? It may come up later, and so you won't be able to have any other chance to testify to some of us about the ANILCA RTC thing, and I thank you, Representative Huffy, for not putting it in his bill. I'm having a meeting this morning, actually, with some of the people from there just to understand better who all is in there. Would there really be savings if they were taken out and put in some other facilities? They would have to be secure facilities, right?
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I think over on the Senate side, DHS has claimed some savings, but I think so far, in fairness, it's an example of how can we get savings and how can we back into a plan that achieves those savings. Obviously, there's been delays in the Senate coming forward with their bill because of fiscal notes and the accuracy, et cetera. So there are claims that would occur, but I can't speak to that other than DHS may make that claim.
Well, thanks. I'll ask you more. Thank you.
I think the idea there is that if they go into 16 beds or less, we get federal match. If they're in 17 or more, we don't get federal match.
Mr. Chair, do we have to build those 16-bed things still, or are there some that are sitting on empty waiting for people to go?
My understanding is they would have to, most of them would have to be built.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McAfee. Lawrence Massa from the Minnesota Hospital Association. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you.
I assume we'll see you tomorrow as well.
Yes, you will. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lawrence Massa, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Hospital Association, representing our 147 hospitals and 17 health systems throughout the state. At our January board meeting, the Minnesota Hospital Association's board of directors agreed to four principles that would guide our advocacy efforts during this very difficult legislative session. We would like to thank Chairman Huntley and the members of this committee for constructing an omnibus health and human services bill that puts in place these four principles. Our first principle was to oppose cuts that increase the number of uninsured in Minnesota. We are most grateful that House File 1362 will keep eligibility for some 113,000 adults enrolled in Minnesota Care, and that the Health Care Access Fund will be preserved rather than inappropriately rolled into the general fund. Healthcare providers across this state are quite adamant that monies raised through the provider tax should be used for their intended purpose and provide health care for working poor Minnesotans and provider payments. In addition, we are pleased that the House budget bill does not implement the radically scaled back general assistance medical care program that was included in the governor's revised budget recommendations. These two provisions are extremely important to Minnesota's hospitals because without Minnesota Care and GAMC, the growth of uncompensated care and bad debt at our hospitals would be astronomical. Our second principle was to work to protect federal matching funds. Throughout House File 1362, there are multiple provisions where the committee is using creative approaches to leverage federal dollars back to Minnesota. We applaud these efforts. Our third principle was to support spreading cuts even more evenly across state programs. The members of the Minnesota Hospital Association want to do all that we can to keep the financial target for this division at the $400 million level. Healthcare cannot endure disproportionate share of budget cuts this year. As you have all seen in recent headlines, hospitals are under enormous financial pressure, and this recession is hitting hospitals very hard. Given that hospitals had medical assistance rate cuts in 2002, 2003, 2005, and 2008, we are opposed to further rate cuts, especially considering that they are cumulative. We are, however, appreciative of the fact that House File 1362 seems to cut all providers fairly and across the board. It is important for committee members to understand that this 3% rate cut represents approximately $51 million in lost payments to our hospitals when federal matching dollars are included. Hospitals would now be paid at our 2002 cost minus 16.47%. Our final principle was to support raising additional revenues to solve this budget deficit. While revenue enhancements are not included in this bill, the Minnesota Hospital Association is grateful that the House recognizes that new revenue sources need to be part of the budget solution, and that is why the bill with this target is at $400 million. This hospital simply can't endure additional rate cuts. We would urge the committee to stand firm and do not accept further cuts that may be added to the bill in the future. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and thank you for your hard work.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Massa. I am curious. I noticed that in your testimony you mentioned that Minnesota Care and GAMC help you prevent uncompensated care. However, low provider payments have been a criticism from your organization. The fact that you've got a $10,000 inpatient maximum on Minnesota Care that a lot of people blow through and result in uncompensated care. Don't you have uncompensated care from those programs as well? Maybe not as much.
That's correct. We still do, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we still do have uncompensated care from the underpayment situation. Simply eliminating all payment, however, would be much worse for our hospital.
Even if there was an alternative, like something that paid you commercial rates.
That would be an excellent alternative. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Actually, Representative Gottwald, we got somebody trying to look up the numbers, but it appears to me that roughly 24-25% of your health care premium is to cover underpayments by our programs, by Medicare, and by the uncompensated care. So it's... The people never go away, and they still show up at the hospital, and somebody's going to pay. Representative Abler.
That makes him the white knight, I guess, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Massa. Welcome back. I asked Mr. Klein about ER use, and do you have any idea, or it would be helpful, I think, if you don't have an idea right now, to figure out what the incidence of people appearing in ERs is, and, you know, it seems to me like just a regular clinic, I mean, urgent care is defined as after hours, but do you have any idea about what percentage of the people who wind up in the ER really could have been served anywhere else if they were open?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, members of the committee, I know each hospital tracks those numbers as they put their staffing programs together. I don't have that information. I think you see fewer visits after 11 o'clock at night. You see some increase in visits after closing hours of the clinics at 5:30. And I know a lot of hospitals do have urgent care where they own the clinic in their community. They do provide some after-hours care. So I know that some things are being done in that area. But we could provide that data if you needed it. Each individual hospital collects it. We don't collect it as an association, but we could certainly do some survey work.
And Mr. Abler, I had a chat with the CEO of my local hospital, and he was reminding me that the bricks cost about 7 or 8% on all the rest of staff. And it seems like staff aren't allowed to do, you know, big stuff that they may not even be called on to do. So I'm sympathetic to the challenge. I just keep thinking of ideas to try to get us through this time, and you're aware. I appreciate the testimony today. I think productive, and you're aware that this will be a discussion next year and thereafter. As you look at the tails, this is something we need to keep working on, so I don't mind helping with that. So good luck.
Other questions? Well, thank you, Mr. Massa, for your testimony. Next is Dave Renner from the Minnesota Medical Association.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. Dave Renner, representing the Minnesota Medical Association, representing physicians throughout the state. First, I'd like to say I agree with most of what Mr. Massa said, and it will essentially cut down my testimony, because we also share many of the principles that they had raised about trying to protect eligibility, trying to protect those, make sure people have coverage so that we don't end up having to care for these folks with uncompensated care elsewhere. So because of that, we also want to thank you for your efforts to maintain eligibility in our public programs. Also want to thank you for maintaining the optional benefits, even though the optional benefits are not ones that our members bill for directly, they are ones that our members rely upon. Orthopedic surgeons rely on PT services, and family physicians, pediatrics rely on dental coverage to make sure that people are getting their care there. So we appreciate that. Thank you very much. I also want to thank you for maintaining the funding for the SHIP program, the Statewide Health Improvement Program. Part of last year's health reform was to fund the infrastructure for our public health infrastructure. It's the first time in many years the legislature has stepped forward to say that public health needs to be funded. It's a key part to trying to help control health care costs and make sure people get the appropriate care. Talking with the Department of Health just yesterday, my understanding is of the eligible entities that can apply for those programs, all but one or two have, so there's great interest, so we're glad to see that those monies will continue. As for the provider cuts, we realize you have very difficult decisions and none of these are fun. We thank you for trying to at least protect primary care. Again, that was somewhat related to the health reform that you passed last year to help change our payment structures, to help encourage and utilize primary care services more. So we appreciate that. Saying that, however, I do need to remind you, there's a lot of talk about COLAs and rebasing. Physician services in our public programs have received one COLA in 16 years, a 3% raise in year 2000. Rebasing, we have not had our payments rebased since 1992. Physician payments are based on the median charges of 1989 charges. We are hearing more and more from physicians who continue to participate in the program that the financial stresses of the public program, especially when you combine it with Medicare, is creating a fragile system out there. So we acknowledge that this may not be a great year to try to address all these issues, but it is something that eventually the legislature does need to step forward, the governor needs to step forward and ensure that we address this issue. Otherwise, we are fearful that our safety net system may not be able to continue. I also want to point out one somewhat policy issue, and it is on pages 90, 91, 92, and it is the demonstration project that I believe the chair mentioned, talking about payment reform. And I just want to point out once again, it does reintroduce the issues of total cost of care and the issues that were part of last year's health reform discussions but were rejected. We do continue to raise concerns about how the total cost of care concept will move forward, other than in a way that it's not viewed as global capitation or acceptance of insurance risk, and how it will be used in areas other than those who are in fully integrated large systems. How will this work in rural areas? How will this work in smaller clinics? We acknowledge and understand that it is a demonstration project, but we do deem to at least put those concerns back on the table. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Renner, how would you feel if your members were getting paid commercial rates instead of dealing with this entire thing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gottwald, there's no doubt that one of the problems we have in our healthcare system and one of the reasons healthcare costs are going up is because of cost shifting. And the biggest problem in the cost shifting is our public programs, not only Medicaid and our public state programs, but the Medicare program. And so whether they are commercial rates, our members would love that, whether that's where we get to vote for, but at a minimum we need to address the significant cost shifting that's going on in the underfunding in our public programs.
Other questions? Representative Peterson.
If we are paying commercial rates for private pay and for the regular commercial rates, do you think that would cost more money?
Mr. Chair, would it cost the state programs more money to pay more? Yes.
And wouldn't it cost overall more money because there's more money going to doctors?
Mr. Chairman, again, whether the negotiations would take place, if there is less cost shifting going on, the increases, the future increases, the cost that we pay in the commercial rates would either stabilize or in some cases potentially would go down.
And Mr. Chair, you'd expect the commercial rates, the negotiated rates on the commercial side then to come down? And have you had any discussions with the health plans that would actually happen?
Mr. Renner.
Mr. Chairman, we have not had those discussions because we haven't seen the
public program rates go up.
And these aren't fair questions to you, but
right. But there's no doubt. I mean, it's a negotiated rate that some clinics have more clout than others in negotiating. Some health plans have more clout than others in negotiating. But if the cost shifting were to go away, those costs would no longer be passed on to private insurers.
And Mr. Chair, how do the rates for the MCHA program work?
For MCHA?
Yeah. Are those higher rates?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not an expert on that. My understanding is that they are similar to the commercial.
And so, Mr. Chair, if we doubled the amount of people in the MCHA program, do you have any idea what the effect of that would have on, for instance, the taxes, the premium taxes that people have to pay on their their small business plan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, my understanding wouldn't have any impact on premium taxes, but it potentially would have an impact on the assessment that is paid back to the health plan.
Right.
And the concept of MCHA was established always to run a deficit and always to assess back to the health plan. It gets more confusing now when we get into ERISA issues that self-insured are assessed those costs. But the concept of MCHA was exactly that. We would take the uninsurable that insurers decide they're not going to cover, put them into a risk pool, and then we would assess those insurers back as a way to spread that risk among all insurers.
So that would have some effect on the commercial premium rate.
Mr. Chairman, if MCHA were to double, yes, it probably would have a greater impact on that assessment.
Thank you.
No, Representative Gottwald.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. We could debate this quite a bit, Representative Thiessen. We could use David Renner in the middle as kind of an uncomfortable
fulcrum. Have you got another 20 minutes, David?
No. I could ask the question, what if we had another double the people paying into the MCHA premium tax as well? You know, we've debated this policy quite a bit in committee, and my hope is that this won't be the last we discuss it, but it's a very important discussion before we end things up here this session, I think. And I thank Mr. Renner for sitting in the hot seat.
Representative Gottwald, we are still pushing to get a fiscal note on your bill that deals with this, and when that comes, we'll get a hearing, and you know that I sort of agree with you. I'm not interested in putting too many people into MCHA, but we ought to have a program that pays commercial rates. So thank you, Mr. Renner.
Thank you, Mr. Member.
Next is Steve Larson.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson. I'm here representing the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities as well as the ARC of Minnesota. And I wanted to clarify first that on behalf of Long-Term Care Services, Representative Gottwald, we would be in favor of commercial rates. Hopefully that saved us 5 or 10 minutes of discussion. Mr. Chair and committee members, the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities was very pleased to read certain sections of the bill that indicated very much that you're listening about the needs of vulnerable adults. And that included the federal compliance for home and community-based waivers, which will make sure that we're in compliance with what CMS wants and that we'll retain the billions of dollars of waiver dollars that are coming to the state of Minnesota. We also are very pleased to read that will continue to allow for waiver growth in the waiver programs that will meet the needs of people that are on waiting lists or coming out of institutional placements and need community placement in the community. And also, we're very pleased to read about the Region 10 Quality Assurance Project continuing with funding, with the cuts that are going to be in place no matter where we end up with this legislative session. It's going to be important that persons with disabilities, as well as older Minnesotans, have access to a quality assurance system in the community. And Mr. Chair, in particular, I know you are interested in maintaining chiropractic, dental, podiatry, and rehab services, and we think that's vitally necessary and will, in the long run, keep people out of institutions and prevent higher health care costs. However, we are concerned with the reduction in provider rates, and one of our areas of concern is fairness. We've talked about vulnerable adults. Leadership in the governor's office as well as in the legislature have talked about vulnerable citizens and maintaining services for them throughout this legislative session. And yet, when the cuts come, persons with disabilities are taking a substantial part of those cuts, at least 20% in the budget that's proposed here for long-term community-based services. We think that those cuts should be applied in a fair manner. That's one of the principles that we've been asking for and stating throughout the legislative session. So we'd like to consider looking at these cuts and seeing if we can continue to strengthen and maintain a strong community-based system. It's been the goal of the state of Minnesota to get people out of institutional placements, to keep them in their homes, and we knew we were going to have some significant cuts in our programs, but we'd like those cuts to be fair and across all populations. In addition to that, there was language that supported greater use of technology to help persons with disabilities continue to live in their homes, and we think that's a wise decision as we move forward. And we're also very pleased to see the continuing language on the Autism Task Force. And with that, I'd like to introduce Eric Johnsard from LSS that's going to talk about Master Pool Trust. Thank you for your time this morning.
Mr. Chairperson, my understanding was I may have been inadvertently left off the agenda here. My name is Eric Johnsard with Lutheran Social Service, and I thank you for your interest in this and for taking the time to hear our concerns regarding the potential impact to disabled people in Minnesota. I admit, given what I have to say today, may seem like small potatoes, and it's a small section of this bill, but the language has tremendous impact. I'm specifically talking about 70.6 through 70.10, and the language that reads that requiring upon the death of a pool trust beneficiary, any funds remaining in the MA recipient subaccounts be used to fully reimburse the state for the cost of providing MA to the beneficiary before any subaccount funds can be retained by the trust. This has a tremendous impact in three distinct ways. First of all, this requirement seems to be in direct conflict with federal law that establishes the use of the pool special needs trust by disabled people. The federal law allows for people to place their money into these pool trusts and to protect their money, and then to the extent that amounts remaining in the beneficiary's account upon the death of the beneficiary are not retained by the trust then must pay back the state. This proposal seems to be in direct conflict with that, and the attorneys we've worked with very hard on this seem to support our position. The second piece is the requirement actually prevents Minnesota-based nonprofits from providing special needs trusts, which has tremendous impact to both ARC and Lutheran Social Service. The state statute says that a corporation may take, receive, and hold real and personal property, including the principal interest of any money or other fund that's given, conveyed, etc., upon a contingent interest in the trust. Currently, LSS and other Minnesota nonprofits meet the requirement because the federal statute allows for us to remain at least a portion of any potential remainder in these trusts. As written, Minnesota nonprofits would no longer meet our statutory requirements governing our ability to serve as a trustee and the valuable services that LSS and ARC want to be able to provide, as the only in-state nonprofits doing this would be lost to the disabled community in Minnesota. And finally, the third piece is the requirement would have a direct and negative impact on Minnesota's disabled population. I have not seen any figures discussing exactly how much this would save the state, but it seems to be a push, allowing us to retain a small remainder of this versus not. And just a small example, for the people that I have in this trust now, currently if every single person died today, it would result in a difference of $20,000 coming back to the state. The attorney fees I've saved alone in this sort of pool trust are almost probably nearing $100,000. So I don't really understand where the savings comes, and I've talked to DHS, and we haven't seen specific numbers to this particular part of this bill. So I would ask that we take another look at this specific language and possibly come up with an amendment so we can avoid the unintended consequence of not allowing a Minnesota nonprofit to provide this service.
We did get an amendment from you, and we thought that we put the right language in. We'll be certainly willing to work with you to make sure that your problems can be addressed. We won't do it today, but we have a couple more committees to go through that we could. So if you would talk to our staff, and we'll see if we can fix that problem.
Thank you.
Any questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you. And next is Heidi Klozak. I don't see her, so we'll go to Sarah Leverance and Anthony Council 65.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify. I am Sarah Leverance. I am the political and legislative director for AFSCME Council 65. We have 13,000 members in Greater Minnesota, many of whom work in Greater Minnesota hospitals and nursing homes. I want to thank the chair and the members for not cutting the nursing home reimbursement rate in this bill. That is an extremely important thing for the rural Greater Minnesota nursing homes in particular. But you need to know that the current situation in many of the state's nursing homes is very dire, and the lack of an increase for the next 2 years is going to have a significant effect on them. I have with me Mike McCullough, who is the president of our North Country Hospital local, that is 400 members who work in both the North Country Hospital in Bemidji and the nursing home, which is connected with the state. Mike is a nursing assistant who works in the nursing home, and he wants to talk a little bit about some of the problems that the nursing home is having and some of the consequences of those financial problems. Mike?
Yeah. Let's say who I am. As Sarah said, I'm the union president. I've been a steward for 8 years now at North Country. In 2002, the local entered an agreement to create a universal worker in order to look for ways to make our aides efficient and cut corners, save money. I'm a TMA, a TCA, a housekeeper, a cook, an activities aide, a therapy aide, and a peer ergonomics leader. I wear all these hats on most every shift I work. Start with the nurse's aide, you know. Tell people there's a difference between a CNA and a registered nurse's aide. And a lot of people forget the difference. I'm required to keep my name on the National Registry for long-term care in order to work in the facility. An aide that doesn't work for an 8-hour shift in 2 years no longer holds that place on the registry. We're now working at bare-bone staff at the legal minimum. This last couple months, we've re-entered negotiations with North Country in order to find ways to save money and reduce costs. As an employee, I want to remain an employee to my corporation. Some of the cutbacks that have happened in order to save the dollars here and there, they cut back a half an hour overlap on the shift. And then the result for me, it equals no report. I don't get told how the patients did during the day before I come on at 3 o'clock. I work 8 out of 10 shifts, and the employer figures that I know enough about the residents that I can hit the floor running. Before I see a resident, I have to check the kitchen, I have to clean rooms, and I have to have to get my report done in order to get started, just to be in compliance with the laws that are made here.
What about the effect of no report?
I was telling Sarah this morning that a while back I hit the floor running, skipped the report, just like the boss asked. I walked in to answer a call light. The lady was nonverbal, which is indicating she wanted to go to the bathroom. I set her up on the side of the bed, used the easy stand to transfer. When I sat her up on the side of the bed, she cried. I laid her back down and I pushed the call light and waited for my LPN to show up for help. The resident had a broken hip as a result of a fall earlier that afternoon. Had I been told about that fall during report, my approach to that room would have been different. As I said, the patient was nonverbal. She couldn't tell me that she was in pain before I sat her up. In 2004, when we opened up the facility in North Country, the Nielsen place, I started wearing a pedometer to track my mile. The first month we were open, I clocked 12 and a half miles per shift, from 3 to 11. Over the years, I've worked that down, trying to be as efficient as I can, to 5 miles a shift. I never thought that a pedometer would be a management tool, as it turned out to be, but I found a way to measure the decisions my bosses make and the decisions my coworkers make. A coworker can cost me a half a mile on the shift, just from an experience.
What's the financial situation of your nursing home?
Our total reimbursements last year were $6.7 million, with expenses totaling $7.8. It was a $1 million loss. My vice president for the long-term care has told us that we're on track to lose $1.2 million this year. It equals $20 per patient per day for a 78-bed facility. We have 142 staff. Last week, the union sat down with the senior leadership to discuss budget cuts and these current bills that are going through. Our corporation is looking at a 20% cut in the mid-deal line. Somewhere along the line, the corporation has to make at least break even in order to justify keeping the doors open. Out of 142 staff, 20% of them are going to have to go.
Okay, well, thank you. And could you state your name for the tape, please?
My name is Michael McCalla.
Any questions?
We don't know anything about commercial rates. So if you ask me questions about that, I'll say I don't know anything.
Okay, well, thank you for your testimony. And next, I think Paul Fleischner is going to replace Eric Ratzman. And welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Huntley and representatives. No one can replace Eric. I'm going to do my best, though. First of all, I'm Paul Fleischner, Director of Community Services with Olmsted County. I'm also representing the Association of Minnesota Counties and MAC. I'm currently the President-elect. Wanted to thank the committee and appreciate the work that you've done to protect the safety net and avoid cost shifts to counties. Maintaining adults in Minnesota Care and DAMC, I think, is a critical part of our safety net. Expanding the healthcare home model, we think, is a good move. Managing PCA services in a new way makes sense to us. And in particular, we want to thank you for working with us on the Human Services Redesign Framework, that we believe will help us work with the state on a better relationship to improve services and service outcomes. Also want to assure advocates we are not attempting to cut important services. We're trying to fix what we think is a broken relationship by creating a new partnership using powers the Commissioner of Human Services already has. We believe better, not fewer, services will emerge. A great example of innovations to come, I think, are the CD redesign pilots. I think with the framework we've set, other ideas like that will emerge. I think the CD redesign pilot is a great example of how we can start looking at services differently. In addition, we are concerned about provider rate cuts. As I look at my own community right now, my mental health center is considering a possible Chapter 11, and a 3% rate cut will probably push them into Chapter 11, and then we start really looking at what's happening to our safety net. I know you're looking for dollars, but there's some providers that are really hurting, and counties are also worried about that. Our resources are scarce. Demands are growing. I could give you large percentages of growth in things like cash and food coming through our doorway. Our calls in our public assistance area in the last year have doubled. But we do need to change how we do business. Also want to thank you for preserving investments in the future. The CHIP program, we believe, is a critical investment in our future. Generally want to thank you for understanding the breadth and depth of what counties do and supporting vulnerable populations in our communities. I think your budget takes a fair and realistic look considering our circumstances. And then on a personal note, working and being part of Regional 10 Quality Assurance over the years, I just wanted to thank you for supporting that because I've been involved in that project. I'd like to see that kind of quality assurance in all our systems. And in general, just thank you for your thoughtful work toward this budget.
Thank you. Questions? Don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. And next is Mary Reagan. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, which is a statewide association of providers of treatment services for children and adolescents in Minnesota. I want to add our thanks to you, for, as others have commented, for your hard work on this and for the difficult task we know you have before you. I would also add our support for the commercial rate idea for services. We'd be in favor of that as well. We are concerned, though, about the 3% cut for basic care services, which includes children's therapeutic services and supports, which are in-home and day treatment services for emotionally disturbed children. These are services that have been historically underfunded, which you recognized in recent years by increasing some of the rates for those services. But even with those increases, providers are struggling significantly to continue to serve children with SED in their homes and communities. And a number of my members have expressed fear that they will not be able to continue to provide this service with further cuts. Excuse me. We're also concerned about the proposal to redesign the personal care assistance services, which virtually eliminates the use of these supports for children with emotional disturbances. There is a CPSS service called Mental Health Behavioral Aids, which might be an alternative to PCAs for children with emotional disturbances, but that rate is currently so low that very few providers are able to even offer that service, and that would also be subject to the 3% cut. Another area that will significantly impact our members are the licensing fee increases. For residential programs serving children, that increase is over 1,000%. So a small group home with 8 beds would go from a $400 a year licensing fee to
to a $4,400 a year licensing fee. Unlike most of the other schedules in the bill, the licensing fee increases for this group is not tied to number of beds, number of certifications. It's just a flat across the board increase. And that will be a problem. We have some concerns about the county redesign. We recognize that there needs to be change, that there's potential for this to be a positive thing, but we're concerned about whether there'll be adequate involvement of advocates, whether meaningful outcome measures can be developed, and whether an effective accountability system can be enforced. We also, I think as you know, have worked hard on services and supports for youth aging out of foster care. And we're happy that the committee supported Representative Loeffler's bill to extend Medicaid coverage to those youth, and also Chair Huntley's bill to extend Minnesota care coverage to those youth. However, we don't seem to see either of those in this proposal and are concerned about that. So thank you for your work. We do support revenue increases and want to make sure you're aware of that. And would be happy to work on any of our concerns if we have the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. And are there questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. Next we have Jessica Webster.
Yeah. Hello, members of the committee. My name is Maureen O'Connell, and I'm with the Legal Aid, the Legal Services Advocacy Project, and I'm with my colleague Jessica Webster. And first, we'd like to start out by thanking the committee for maintaining coverage for the GMC population, and for maintaining coverage for the Minnesota Care parents and adults without children. We'd also like to thank the committee for enacting some of the TIPRA requirements that will allow us to try to get the federal children's money. And we'd also like to thank you for taking some steps towards program simplification for Minnesota Care and medical assistance. And finally, we'd like to thank you for streamlining the state medical review team process. And so we'd like to start out by thanking you for many of the provisions that you've adopted on the healthcare side, and would like to mention a few concerns that we have on the MFIP side, and I'm going to turn it over to Jessica Webster to talk about those.
One additional thank you was to Representative Fritz and the committee for eliminating asset tests for food stamps. This is a no-cost provision, but it will be really important to middle-class families that are falling on hard times for the first time. But we are here to oppose the numerous cuts to the MFIP program. There are at least 8 different cuts to MFIP, and several of these cuts take cash from the state's poorest families and children. One in particular, the $125 SSI penalty, doesn't only take cash from 7,000 poor families. These poor families are sick and disabled. I'm not exaggerating when I say that Legal Aid does represent clients who, when they lose this $125 a month, they will face eviction and they will face homelessness. And it's not a small number of clients either. Because there is still time, albeit a very small amount of time, we really would look forward to working with you on some of these cuts to the MFIP program. Thank you.
And Ms. Webster, could you state your name for the...
Jessica Webster with the Legal Services Advocacy Program.
Okay, questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. And next we have Bridget Stillyander. And you can correct my pronunciation of that.
I usually have to. Good morning, Mr. Chair and Finance Division members. My name is Bridget Stillyander. Thank you for the privilege to offer my testimony on House File 1362. I have been a personal care attendant, PCA, for 12 years, and am the president of the Direct Support Professional Association of Minnesota. I'm also employed by the Direct Care Alliance, as an advocate for PCAs and other direct support professionals on a national and state level. D-SPAM seeks to improve the quality of human services provided to persons with disabilities and older Minnesotans by strengthening the direct support professional workforce. I am the face and voice of one of 45,000 direct support professionals, which includes PCAs in Minnesota. But you probably won't see many of our faces or hear many of our voices because we're an underrepresented and marginalized workforce. I am one of the very few empowered PCAs, so just because you don't hear from much from our labor population doesn't mean that all of the proposed cuts to PCA services won't be devastating to PCAs and the Minnesotans who rely on their low-cost, flexible services to age in place and participate with dignity in community life. Cuts to PCA services will undercut the sustainability of the PCA workforce, which is an unacceptable and short-sighted way to balance the budget and address fraud in the program. D-SPAM members believe that the PCA program can't afford cuts and PCAs can't afford reductions to wages. D-SPAM does, however, support the standardized training of PCAs, which would be an important step toward the professionalization of services. It would be of great importance, though, that the training is informed by PCAs, other direct support professionals, and consumers who use these services. D-SPAM is deeply concerned about the proposal to cap PCA monthly hours at $310 per month. PCAs are a group of Minnesota's working poor and cannot sustain a cut like this. With the wages being significantly less than livable, this group of healthcare service workers would be unfairly restricted from working enough to survive. This limitation will result in dedicated PCAs being forced to leave individuals they are committed to in order to pay their bills. I am not aware of other jobs in which the law enforces a limitation quite like this. And this would be another strike against an already struggling, voiceless workforce. I understand that the image of PCAs has been blackened lately, but from my experience, we are compassionate, extremely hardworking, and loyal. I have stayed with one of my clients for 9 years, 3.5 years after receiving my degree with honors from the University of Minnesota. Through my work as an advocate, I meet lots of people just like me. So, I challenge you not to support the proposed cut to limit monthly PCA hours to 310 hours. There have to be options available to fix the PCA program and balance the budget that won't result in further destabilizing PCA services. I look forward to working with you all to improve PCA services, and I thank you for your work.
Questions? I don't see any, so thank you again for your testimony. And
thank you.
Representative Hodge has a question or a comment.
Just a comment, and because I've had the pleasure of working with Bridget and others, one of the changes that I wanted to have in the PCA draft was to reference direct support professionals instead of PCA. So, Mr. Chair, hopefully that can be an amendment into the next committee. But we kind of ran short on time. But we know that our direct support professionals for the pay and the work that they do, your testimony rings true with me, and we'll try to continue to do the best we can with the limits that we have.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, I've enjoyed working with you, and I appreciate all that you've done for PCA services.
Okay, next is Deborah Schlick.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Deborah Schlick. I'm with the Affirmative Options Coalition. We're a coalition of organizations throughout the state of Minnesota that advocates an effective welfare-to-work program. Given that that's our mission, it may not surprise you that we have significant disappointment in the budget proposals for the Minnesota Family Investment Program in this bill. I want to, and those concerns are similar to those voiced by Legal Services Advocacy Program. I'd just like to call the committee's attention to two important facts that lurk there behind that unpopular word, welfare. The single most common reason a parent applies for cash assistance in Minnesota is that they've just lost a job. That's why the budget forecast shows that for the first time Minnesota is going to see a significant increase in this caseload, a 16% increase in this biennium. They are low-wage workers who are going to be pushed out of work, as many others are right now. And secondly, this program exists because there are children in those families. And when Minnesota did make successful effort at moving families out of poverty after they left welfare, the single outcome that held true the longest was that the children in those families were performing better on test scores years later. That moving children out of the chaos and disruption of poverty quickly has a lifelong impact. Therefore, we don't accept one of the central tensions of this session about whether or not we can hold schools harmless and make deep cuts in a budget like this. And the cut we would look in particular at is the cut to families with disabled parents and children in the household. Most of those families, it's the parent who's disabled. So you have perhaps a mother with schizophrenia and some cognitive disabilities raising a couple of children. To even get to poverty, which truly is a line of destitution, she'd need $18,000 a year. Currently, she's not quite at $13,000 a year. These cuts will push her down to $11,000 a year. You're asking disabled parents in poverty to move further into destitution. We cannot expect good outcomes for our children in that situation. We will continue to look and analyze the possibilities that the Federal Emergency TANF funds offer Minnesota to hold together a strong safety net for these families. We will continue to advocate that those funds hold together the resources those families rely on and not be used as fiscal relief to help the state fill budget holes.
Representative Hodge. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Schlick. The families that you referenced with disabilities, what specific cuts are you?
It's the cut that would cut the monthly grant, the MSIP grant to a family if there's also SSI income. There's 7,000 families that are affected by that cut. The vast majority of those families, it's the parents who the federal government has designated as unemployable because of significant disabilities. They will not replace that lost income with earnings.
Representative Austin. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to clarify that for the committee, that's the SSI penalty of $125 a month that is falling on these families. So hopefully we can do something on that.
Thank you.
Representative Slavik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do hope we can do something about that. Ms. Flick, I've heard you talk about before how much even $100 a month in a low-income family can make a difference. And issues like domestic violence, how kids are doing. Can you just very briefly mention what happens with it, how much it could affect the family?
Representative Sawick and committee members, what happened when Minnesota ran its initial pilot program and brought in outside evaluators to watch the effects of that program over time? That was a program that Minnesota designed intentionally to move families out of poverty as they left welfare. Minnesota succeeded to that extent better than any other of the experiments going on around the nation at the time. And we expected anti-poverty impacts. What they found in the last study published in 2005, that looks back a number of years, was that children who were preschoolers in those families that did indeed leave poverty and leave poverty much sooner than the families left behind on the ASCC program, is that as fifth and sixth graders, they were outscoring the peers from the ASCC program in math and reading tests. So I think the impact to the question is adults can weather much. They can do it at some pain. Children's lives are changed permanently by how long they're allowed to stay in poverty, how long they spend time in homeless shelters, how long their nutrition is cut back as they try and make do with food shelves.
Other questions? I don't think so. Thank you, Ms. Schlick, for your testimony. And next, it's Bridget Menger Anderson. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the House. My name is Bridget Menger Anderson. I work with the Metropolitan Center for Independent Living. Today I'm here to speak with you as a PCA provider, but also as someone who's listened to hours of concerns from the consumers that use our supports and the direct support professionals that we employ. Before I begin, I just need to apologize for my voice. I'm very sick, and I'm pretty sure I'm allergic to stress. This has been a very stressful session, and so I do apologize, and I'm not sure how long my voice will hold out. I'd like to talk today about my opposition to the 310 cap for PCAs to work per month. I believe that this wages an economic war on DSPs. It sets an unfair labor standard that suggests that anyone who isn't a DSP is allowed to work more than one job in the same field. For example, within multiple retail, customer service, even nurses within different hospitals. But if you're a DSP and you work 40 hours with one consumer and then work an intermittent asleep overnight with another consumer with a different agency, that additional income that you came to depend on and budget every penny from will no longer be available to you. This is not the kind of job market or economy to expect that displaced workers will easily or readily find comparable income. Another way that this 310 cap affects consumers is that if they use a direct support professional for a vacation to go to a work conference, they currently can be expected to work up to 16 hours per day for the Department of Labor regulations. This is where the consumer is now going to have to bring more than one PCA or direct support professional along with them. I just want to remind the committee that when consumers bring DSPs on vacations, that almost all of those expenses are out of pocket for the consumer. For consumers who've been allocated more than 10 hours a day and have only one DSP, and this is usually a consumer who has a divorced spouse or a sibling who's not providing the support, it forces them to have additional DSPs if they choose not to, because some cares are so personal and private that they do not want anyone other than the person they've hired to provide the support. The consumer may make the decision to not bill all of these hours, and even if the supports continue to be provided, down the road when the consumer is reassessed, it gives the impression that they haven't been using all of their hours. The consumer is given a lesser number of hours for that renewal period. So yes, I see how this reduction can save the state money, but really we need to be honest and say, how is it saving money? It's on the backs of the DSP workers' wages, and it's cutting consumer hours unfairly. I understand that there's very significant cuts that need to be made, that you have a difficult job ahead of you. And if we have to accept this 310 cap, I want to propose some ways that we could make it workable. The 310 cap has to be a monthly average. In several committees I've attended, I've heard support that they want to make it a weekly. If we break it down into a weekly average, as some have suggested, we run a greater risk of an agency not getting reimbursed for wages paid to the DSP. Because the current protocol seems to be the first agency to bill is the first agency to get paid. As well as we limit staffing options that are needed on an emergency basis or for vacation purposes, as I mentioned previously. We're also going to need DHS to develop an online tool that will allow providers to go in and check the biweekly hours that have been billed under a PCA provider number. Agencies are going to need documented protocols and provider enrollment support regarding the wage and hour disputes that we're going to have with the Department of Labor for the PCAs that continue to work more than 310 hours a month. I want to mention that this tracking by providers is yet another additional administrative requirement that will be placed on us that will not be matched with financial compensation, but rather as you propose the 3% cuts, you're continuing to ask us to do more with even less. And finally, if we have to accept this 310 cap that's going to devastate incomes for personal care attendants and direct support professionals, we must push for the inclusion of the direct support professional workers to be included in the Fair Labor Standards Act. Direct support professional hours are being reduced. Barriers are being put in place for them to work additional hours that they and their families have come to budget from. At the very least, what we can do is ensure that they are under the same classification as other workers and receive the same rights and protections, including overtime at 40 hours, not 48. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I thank you for taking the time to hear me today.
thank you for your testimony and other questions. I don't see any, so thank you. Next is Ann Henry.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center at the Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis. First, we want to thank you for your service in this committee. It really is a hazardous committee to serve on. I think we all know that this session, so we appreciate it. We also appreciate that adults with disabilities will continue to have access to dental care, to rehab services, OT, PT, speech, chiropractic, podiatry in your budget. We appreciate that the home and community waiver slots are not cut for the coming biennium, which we think is so important given the fact that these important services have been cut almost every year back to 2002. And access is extremely important when you look at a lot of the other cuts that are going to happen. We do want to express our concern that we share with a couple of the previous speakers on the MFIP cuts for families affected by disability, the MFIP SSI cuts. This is just an extremely harsh cut, and we really hope that there will be found another way to avoid that cut. It will devastate these families affected by disability poverty who have young children. We're concerned, of course, about the provider rate cuts both in health care and community support services, but I want to turn now to the PCA cuts. And while we can't thank you for cutting our clients who need PCA services, we can thank you for being less harsh than the governor. And that's very important. And we also thank you for the many integrity changes and improvements in the program, which we really need. Nonetheless, these PCA cuts will hurt many people, likely 5,500 people, perhaps more. 500 to 800 folks are going to be eliminated entirely. Although we don't have the data from DHS yet, we expect those folks will have the same profile as the larger number the governor proposed to cut, which is 70 to 75% children and adults in the mental health system with mental health needs. I just want to make two last points. Clearly, the challenges we have in community support services and long-term care are going to continue. And because of that, we support the development of the Minnesota Compass assessment that the Department of Human Services has been working on. We believe that we need an assessment tool across age and disability that is more sensitive than we have so that we can direct our resources as fairly and responsibly as possible. We don't have that tool right now. And I know it is a horrible time to try to invest in anything, but we're going to continue to face awful choices. And I see this session that we've made some decisions that we wouldn't have made if we had that better information. We're going to cut people who are going to have to go to nursing homes instead of stay in the community, and we're going to give more hours of PCA service to people who don't need it, who aren't asking for it. So we need a better assessment tool. The last point is that the disability community has had a very rough time working on PCA services with health plans this session. And there are a few points that I want you to keep in mind because I don't think this will be the last time you hear about PCA services this session. Health plans serve in managed care the senior population. They have about 4,000 people who use PCA services in managed care. The disability population under 65 who have been certified as totally and permanently disabled covers about 14,000 monthly average folks. And the range of folks and the nature of their conditions, I think, is quite a different profile than the health plans see in their plans. And another point to keep in mind, if people are destabilized and end up in institutions, the state, of course, will bear the cost for people under 65. And for health plans, they only have to pay the cost for 6 months. And then these people are off their books. They can wash their hands of them. So we really urge a lot of care, and we appreciate the tracking of the changes that you have put in your budget. Thank you.
Thank you. Question for Ms. Henry? Thank you. Michael Scandrett. welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Scandrad, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition. The coalition is made up of providers and organizations that provide services to low-income, uninsured, and disadvantaged Minnesotans, including mental health, health care, community-based services, and dental services. Again, this serves the poorest of the state, many of whom do not have health coverage and don't have the resources to pay for health care themselves. And basic message for you today is thanking you for what you've done to try to preserve the safety net for the neediest of Minnesotans. And as you know, the safety net providers are not just coping with the possible cuts in programs and eligibility, but also are seeing dramatic increases in the number of patients that are coming to them who are uninsured. They've lost their jobs, they've lost their health coverage. So they're experiencing very dramatic cuts in other ways due to the economy, and what you've done in the bill to try to preserve the basic services and the subsidies that are provided to safety net providers is really vitally important to keep that safety net there, something we take for granted but can no longer take for granted in the current climate. One thing I want to comment a little further on is on the health reform demonstration project. And Mr. Chair, I think there's more savings in the bill than you have counted in your spreadsheet. I think these types of projects truly can reduce net overall costs to the state. And there are safety net providers and others that are interested in doing the projects, interested in committing to reduce total costs. And would want to continue to work with the department and with legislators to quantify the savings that those projects will produce. So with that, just thank you again for your hard work and for preserving the safety net for the neediest Minnesotans. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions? Don't say anything, so thank you, Mr. Scandrett. And next is Drew Abderholden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. I think the title of my testimony should be The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. The good is that you kept Minnesota Care and GAMC intact. We really appreciate that. We appreciate that you kept dental care, OT, and the other services. You know, people with mental illness on certain medications get dry mouth, and that creates more cavities and gum disease. We appreciate the SMART team review process, the crisis flexibility, equalizing the children's partial hospitalization rates with adults, buying out the Rule 5, and bringing together the stakeholders to figure out how to really use the mental health services funds allocated to the CCSA grants. Now to the bad. Bad is certainly the 3% cuts of providers. Mental health providers serve a higher percentage of people who are on medical assistance or uninsured. Most of them operate on a 1% margin, so this will be very difficult for them. The 5.2% cut to inpatient mental health services, again, it's a usually very higher percentage of people on MA who are served in inpatient mental health units, so that cut will be difficult for them. And the MSFIT cuts in terms of the SSI is also a problem. Now to the ugly. The personal care assistance changes are really devastating to the mental health community. I spent the weekend really reading it, talking to families with kids on the program and some adults. And there's a couple of problems with it. One is if you really read what a level one behavior is, which is they have to exhibit four times a week physical aggression to others, self, or property. What I can tell you is that if someone with a mental illness, a child or adult, meets that criteria, they're not at home. They're in the hospital. They're in residential treatment. So how could you possibly get PCA services and exhibit that in a week? The other is that the instrumental activities of daily living, you have to have two activities of daily living dependencies. And that's, you know, those instrumental activities are what people with mental illness use the most. They don't need help actually bringing the spoon up. They need help with, planning out their meals. How are they going to keep their apartment clean and free of clutter and things like that? The third issue is that there's a clause in there that says that you don't qualify for PCA services if the adult
is they're not dependent in an ADL if that was due to an individual choice. Well, if someone's delusional or psychotic, how is maybe, you know, keeping all the paper, you know, every free newspaper they find gets cluttered up and someone says, well, you know, they really need help keeping their house clean because that's a free choice. If they're not eating because they feel that the food has been poisoned, is that a free choice? So we're really concerned that that clause is going to prevent lots of people from mental illness from qualifying for the PCA program. You know, I realize that people were saying, well, you know, there's been a huge increase in the number of people with mental illness onto the PCA program. And I think when you think about it, you have to think, well, there isn't anything else. How do you get help with, you know, making sure your medications get refilled? How do you get help with being able to stay in your apartment? How do you get help with making sure that you're eating and things like that? So I am really, really concerned. I think at the very least, that the PCA report from the department needs to include really hard data about who's getting kicked off. I think that 500 number is really, really low. And I think you should track it. I think you should find out what happens to those people 6 months later so that we really have really good data about what happens. The other recommendation I would make, and Mary Regan mentioned it, is that we would love people to, some of the children at least, to go to the CTSS services. However, they can't find people to be behavioral health aides. We would recommend that you, and we have developed some language, so that the hours that you work as a mental health behavioral aide 1 count for the hours you need to become a behavioral health aide 2 that count for being a mental health practitioner. So that while you might not get paid much, you actually are on a career path, and so it will lead at least to something else and a better paying job. The other ugliest that I would like to bring up is the county redesign project. I want you to remember that in the beginning of the session, NAMI and other mental health advocates worked very closely with the counties on the whole issue of the mental health maintenance of effort. We spent hours in rooms, in meeting rooms, trying to figure out, you know, what would those performance assessments be? What would those performance measures be? We realized there were two issues facing the counties. One was they needed some relief from their maintenance of effort requirements because they were going to have less county funds. That's different than saying we'd like to move to performance measures. And we came up with an agreement that would allow for both. And what we realized in those many hours together is that coming up with performance measures in mental health is very, very difficult. You know, they would come up with something about number of people served, but that's to me the same as saying keep those same number of dollars there. You know, if you look at, you know, what is access, what is appropriateness, what is effectiveness, what is equity, what is efficiency, those are very, very difficult things to get at. You know, do you just look at the waiting list or do you look, or do you ask the sheriff how many, you know, what do you think? Is the county doing a better job than before? When you look in the bill, and I've read it very carefully at 3 hours this morning, there's two things that happen. One is that you have a steering committee that will develop performance and outcome measures. I want to point out that you have 6 county staff, the county people on there, representatives, 3 county commissioners and 3 county administrators. You have 4 clients or advocacy groups. Now, if you're doing all of the service redesign, how could you possibly have those 4 people represent all the needs that are out there? Even with our mental health MOE group, we had people who knew children's services, who knew adult services, who knew the provider side. You know, you need to bring all those people together. This is extremely complex. So having just 4 clients or advocacy groups is just not sufficient. The second thing that's in there is the state-county results accountability and service delivery change. On that council that would direct this whole project, there are no consumers or advocacy groups. There are 0 on there. Secondly, you know, and I guess I would throw out the phrase, you know, nothing about us without us. You know, you're talking about counties coming together, totally redesigning the service system, and we're nowhere on the picture. And most importantly, if you look on line 263.12, this permits the Commissioner of Human Services to allow for funding and expenditure flexibility, and the only thing that's listed there is the mental health maintenance of effort. So I kind of feel like we spent hours and hours of session trying to work something out on the maintenance of effort for mental health, and in that one small sentence, we're allowing the commissioner as counties come together to just waive it. No input, no legislative review of it, no real, you know, assurance about what those performance measures will be, And I just think that's not okay. Lastly, when you look at this, it says, you know, this is about results, accountability, and service. I've read through this over and over and over again, and there is nothing in there about how we hold counties accountable. There's nothing. There's absolutely nothing. And I think we need to have a much clearer picture about if we're going to provide flexibility, how are we at the same time going to hold them accountable? We have to have specific accountability features in that. Does it mean we withhold money? Does it mean that we go after them? I mean, we get calls into our office all the time about things that really aren't appealable. You know, the voluntary placement agreement, that the law that you passed last year, says right in there that the county can't return that child home for 72 hours. You need that 72-hour notice. I mean, we're starting to rack up the numbers where families are getting calls saying, you bring your child home now or we're going to file a CHIP petition. How do we hold the county accountable for that? Earlier testimony said that this whole provision created a new partnership. But again, I want to say it's a partnership between the state and the counties and not the people that are being served. This section of the bill really is just totally unacceptable to us, and I hope that you will work with us to beautify this proposal. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Ms. Averholden, if you would work with Representative Loeffler and Representative Keeson, they're kind of leading the maintenance of effort thing and the county redesign, and you know, we're listening to you, and but they're the two that are leading on that. So if you would talk to them,
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think, as you can tell, I'm a little passionate about that.
I could tell. Any questions? Thank you for your testimony. And next is Jonathan Watson. Oh, there he is.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Watson. I'm the Associate Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. As you may know, there are 17 community health centers or federally qualified health centers in the state. We serve about 180,000 patients. 40% of those are uninsured. Another 40% are on a public program. We serve about one out of every six uninsured Minnesotans. I'm here today to both thank you and support many of the provisions of House File 1362, especially compared to the governor's budget and supplemental budget. First and foremost, it's my understanding of reviewing the spreadsheet that the Community Health Center appropriation of $2.5 million funded out of the Healthcare Access Fund is still in the budget as considered by this committee. Those funds are used to continue to expand and improve services for low-income Minnesotans. What that money actually means on the ground level, I should let you know what your return on investment is on those dollars, is that the health centers can use these in any shape or form that they do, so as long as they improve access. There's a lot of lab tests and medication provided to the uninsured at Lake Superior Community Health Center in Duluth. Mental health services have been added at the Native American Community Clinic in the Phillips neighborhood. And in Cook, Minnesota, they're adding training their staff on electronic health record in order to enhance services to their patients. So on the ground level, it is working. All the clinics do devote a portion of these funds to retain and recruit the providers that work at community health centers. And they also use a portion of these funds to offset the cost to serve the uninsured, which is approximately $32 million in the last calendar year. These funds are really critical in this time, as has already been said today, but with the economy collapsing and employer-sponsored health care diminishing, we're seeing a phenomenon of folks driving from the suburbs and exurbs into the inner city of Minneapolis and St. Paul and traveling great distances for care in rural Minnesota. There's about 827 zip codes in the state. We draw patients from about 52% of those zip codes. So we are truly much beyond our immediate service area in terms of the patients we see. We do support a lot of the other provisions in this bill and have been mentioned before, but let me just highlight them very quickly. Keeping the health care access fund intact, we share the hope with you that health care reform will continue in the state, and that is obviously a way to fund those efforts. Is the healthcare access fund, so keeping that intact is critical. The colorectal screening program, I understand that that's a pilot program at this point, but we hope that will eventually, the lessons learned from that program will be expanded in future years. We have about 10,000 patients, uninsured patients, that fit that target population that could benefit from that program. The 3% rateable reduction that excludes primary care providers, we're glad to see that you understand the value
of paying primary care providers. You know, community health centers, our likelihood of our patients using an emergency room is about 20% less than a non-community health center user. So recognizing the value of primary care is critical. And lastly but not least, the maintaining the eligibility. The childless adults in Minnesota care, the dental services, and the critical access dental provider, that's 40% of our patients are on some sort of public program. So keeping those programs intact to support the financial solvency of the community health centers in the state of Minnesota. That is all I have. I'm available for some questions.
Any questions for Mr. Watson? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And Charlie Oakes? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. I won't pretend that I read the bill. I drove in from Wilmer this morning. I got up about 5 o'clock this morning. I run a program that defines working jobs for adults with disabilities, part of which is a licensed day training and rehabilitation center, part of which is a community rehab program. And so I represent MNDACA, which represents Minnesota Day Treatment and Rehabilitation Program. I also serve as president of MACRO, which is the Minnesota Association of Community Rehab Providers. And I am sort of going to pinch hit a little bit for ARM, which is the residential providers today, because we weren't able to scramble to get enough folks to come in. The truth is, our industry is shorthanded. The truth is, my personal experience of that is that about a year ago, I had about 72 staff, and now I have about 60 staff. It's difficult to find people to come down to talk to you anymore, and that's a shame, because while our staff numbers are less, our client numbers are higher, and our demands are greater. And that's also true in residential facilities across the state as well. Peggy and I, my wife, Lynn Peggy, she and I started out as psychiatric technicians in state hospitals 30 years ago. And then we were house parents in group homes for 3.5 years. And now I've been doing day vocational services for folks with disabilities since then. And she's gone into the public school system in special ed. As we dismantle this system, we have wonderful, dedicated people that make far too little, that are trying to keep way too many plates spinning all at the same time. And they are sticking their necks out to do things that they probably aren't capable of doing to try to keep this system going and to keep everyone safe and to keep everyone having opportunities. And part of that is the evolution, the amazing revolution of services in just my short career. In that now over half of the folks that I work with now have community jobs. 10 years ago that wasn't true. But that's what the families want, and that's what the advocates want, and that's what the licensing wants, and that's a good situation for everybody. Neil's a greeter at Walmart. He loves it. Susie's working at Kentucky Fried Chicken. She loves it. We have people bailing cardboard at the recycling center. They're making more money. They're living longer. They're having less behavioral incidents. They're spending less time in the criminal justice system. They're spending less time in the emergency mental health system, which in Wilmer costs $1,000 a day if people don't take their meds and they don't have a predictable routine and they don't have a support structure to keep them from getting into trouble, and they end up in the emergency crisis mental health system. If they come to our program, we cost about what it costs for children's daycare. A day of my services in our day training rehabilitation program costs less than my oil change down at Walt's Car Wash. There are things that cost money, and there are things that save money. I also sort of listening to the personal care center people here sort of struck a chord with me, because my youngest daughter, who graduated with honors from St. Cloud State a couple of years ago and then went and did AmeriCorps out on the West Coast for 2 years, now she's back in Wilmer. She's a personal care attendant for people with mental health issues, people that no longer will be eligible for personal care attendants under the governor's proposed budget. She's a magna cum laude, graduate of St. Cloud State. I'm happy to be making $8 an hour and living in my basement and eating out of my refrigerator, and you and the rest of the taxpayers are lucky to have her and the thousands of other young people like her that are picking up the slack in the mental health system. My employees this year basically had their wages frozen, their benefits frozen. Health insurance went up 20%. We passed that entirely along to our employees. We've had a hiring freeze in place. We told them that we don't see any end of the tunnel, let alone any light. And yet they still show up. And many of them have second jobs working as group homes or as personal care attendants because they don't make enough money working for me either. They don't make enough, the truth is, they don't make enough money working for you. Because the state of Minnesota has delegated these tasks through nonprofit corporations to make sure that the most vulnerable people of our population have some sort of decency and dignity and safety to their life. Now, there was a poll that was hired by the Governance Council on Developmental Disabilities about a year and a half ago that was professionally done and that was statistically valid. It said 98% of Minnesota taxpayers think it's a good use of tax money to pay for work training programs for adults with disabilities. Folks that in every generation prior to ours lived segregated institutional lives. I tell you, sir, when we have cut 10% of our budget, and now we will apparently cut another 3% of our budget, and then another 3% the following year, at a time when the cost of groceries has gone up 10%, and the cost of insurance has gone up 20%, means that something's going to give. Something's going to break, and people will be damaged as a result of it. And that is the... that is the nightmare that keeps me awake at night. When I was a kid growing up watching Roy Rogers, I was led to believe that it was a privilege for the able-bodied to take care of the elderly and the weak and the disabled, and not some sort of burden that we avoid, right, particularly when the chips are down. Well, the chips are down, and as one of the able-bodied, I would encourage everyone to try to deal with this in a way that protects the most fragile and the most vulnerable. First off, we need to be treated fairly. We can't be treated worse than nursing homes and everyone else that's at the table. And secondly, maybe the able-bodied have to do a little more when things are difficult, until we turn this situation around. So I thank you for your time. I appreciate the difficult task you have ahead of you, but I know that you also appreciate the difficult task that my staff is faced with, both at day programs and residential programs around the state of Minnesota.
Well, thank you for your very moving testimony. Are there questions for Mr. Oak? Well, I don't think so. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Dick Derrick? The Dental Association? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Dick Dirks. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Dental Association. The Minnesota Dental Association represents over 80% of the dentists in the state of Minnesota. The budget cuts initially proposed in the governor's budget for dentistry were devastating. They struck at the core of oral health care for many Minnesotans, and at a time when an increasing number of people are not able to afford care, the central programs which bring oral health care to many Minnesotans were proposed for elimination or reduction. And we should not be getting those programs at a time when there are so many more who are in need. I'm very pleased to see that the House budget for dental services does not cut dental services nearly as severely as it initially proposed. There were four major areas of concern in providing the oral health care to low-income Minnesotans. First, there was the elimination of adult dental care for non-pregnant adults, which would have forced many people into emergency rooms to take care of their oral pain. The MDA is very pleased to see that the worst of these dental cuts in this area have been avoided and alternative reductions found so as to maintain a certain level of care for adults and to avoid an increase in wasteful cost shifting to hospital emergency rooms. Second, elimination of the Critical Access Dental Provider Program would have made dental care much less accessible. Dental offices would have no longer been able to treat anywhere near the number of public program patients that they have been able to without the Critical Access Dental Provider Program. The percentage of public program patients who are able to access care has been held constant for many years because of this program, and this is despite the fact that there is a substantially larger number of public program patients to be seen. Without the Critical Access Dental Provider Program, the number of public program patients seeing a dentist each year would have dropped precipitously from the current rate of 44% to a substantially lesser percentage. So the MDA is also very pleased that the elimination of the Critical Access Dental Provider Program has been avoided. Unfortunately, the rateable reduction of 3% will affect access to dental care. Reimbursement rates for dental care are already amongst the lowest in the country, and the dental access problem will certainly be exacerbated by that. And fourth, the elimination of the Health Care Access Fund is universally opposed by dentists. Dentists pay about $35 million a year into the provider taxes and believe that these taxes should be dedicated to health care as originally intended. So the MDA is also pleased that the House bill does not eliminate the Health Care Access Fund. I would like to express appreciation for the work done by Representative Bunn, Representative Tao, Representative Norton, Representative Abler, and others who worked so hard to develop an alternative approach to budget reductions in dentistry. Dentistry needs to take its fair share of cuts, but the initial proposals were excessive. The alternative approach in the bill of limiting services and limiting the benefits set is unfortunate and will mean that patients will not get optimal care, but this approach is much preferable to the original proposals. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Questions for Mr. Derrick? Well, Cindy, thank you for your testimony, and thank you for working with Representative Bunn and trying to minimize the damage that we're doing.
We worked very hard to pull a new approach together.
Okay, Brad Trahan and Heidi Kluzek. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having us here, Huntley, members of the committee. My name is Brad Trahan from Rochester, Minnesota. I'm a past chair of the Minnesota Senate Autism Task Force that we met from October of 2008 to March of 2009. I'm also a founder of an autism foundation in Rochester, Minnesota with my wife, Joni. And finally, I'm also a very proud parent of a son named Reese Trahan who has severe autism. I'm asking you to support the Joint House Senate Autism Task Force. This task force was developed as a team. We met biweekly from October to March and decided it was time we needed to have a Joint House Senate Autism Task Force. We had two public forums. One was with the family's perspective. With regards to on a cold November night, we had 200 people turn out and literally cry for help. They are having a difficult time navigating the system. We had a professional's perspective where we had physicians, social services, therapy providers all come out, and the message was loud and clear. It's time in the state of Minnesota that we better collaborate and coordinate all services and aspects of ASD, Autism Spectrum Disorders. We also created a task force that had over 1,400 members to us in over just from January till February. We have 76% of our families out there that answer the question that have had to quit work moderately or altogether to care for their child with or individual with autism. That is also one less Minnesota taxpayer. We have 90% of the families out there that answer the question that are facing very major financial stress. Autism is so complex, there's no easy answer. But what we bring to the table is a non-fiscal bill. We want to be part of the solution to the problem. We're not coming to St. Paul and asking that we need this for trillions of dollars of this and that. We have a group of volunteers in the medical profession, therapy providers, individuals themselves in ASD. We want to be part of the solution. Because if we're going to come to St. Paul, we want to make sure that we're better educating and advocating. So if we're going to make positive change throughout the years to come, this is what we're asking for. I will gladly entertain any questions you have at this time. And ironically, I must say, I just came from Rochester, speaking to over 150 law enforcement officers, public safety, fire, speaking to another 80 tomorrow. The message I heard from them today as well is thank you for coming, because we need to be better educated as it relates to autism. We spoke to EMS personnel. We are getting more and more calls as public safety going out and treating situations where individuals with autism need help. Just back in 1980, every one in 20,000 births, there was a diagnosis of autism. Today, every one in 150 diagnosis of autism is occurring. In the state of Minnesota, from 2008 sentences from Minnesota Department of Education, from birth to 21, we had over 12,000 individuals identified in ASD receiving necessary services. And you know what? What's scary for the state of Minnesota is that number has gone up 17% each year of the past 5 years. We are in a major crisis, and we bring to you today, Chair Huntley and members of the committee, to please allow this to go through and let us continue to do the work and be part of the solution to the state of Minnesota, so we can help individuals who are going to soon be adults, so we can help public schools through this widely affects, so we can help our physicians, help our taxpayers. Our goal is simply one message. Let's take our individuals with autism and allow them to one day be tax participants, not tax recipients. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Kluzek.
Good morning, committees and chairman, Mr. Chair. My name is Heidi Kluzek. I represent the Minnesota Autism Society. And I also was a member of a recent Senate task force, which we had 6 months to complete as much as we could. And there's so much to be done. And so one of the major things that we did do as a task force is that we assembled a bill that is part of what we're talking about today, that is what we're talking about today. It includes a variety of people that we felt were, as a task force, we felt were imperative to the next task force. Autism is very complex and encompassing. It's systemic. It is head to toe. It is birth to death. And any individual with autism has the exact same life expectancy as you and I. It covers a spectrum. So you might have a severely disabled to a very high functioning person. And what we've noticed, and we can look at IEP numbers, and we've noticed over the years where we used to have autism down here and we have other disabilities that are up here, they've shifted. And one major thing that we need to see happen is also the dollar, the shift. What we've done is we've become much better at diagnosing. We've become much better at treating or intervening. It is not curable. But if we intervene early enough, we can really make a change in a person. Somebody who we thought, my child, who we thought was not, he was going to be dependent on other people his entire life, we now see he's age 8, third grade, and he's been in intervention for 6 years, and we see how far he's come and how verbal he is, and what choices now he's able to make, and make good choices. So we really have high hopes that he will assimilate not only into a regular classroom full-time, but also he will assimilate into society and hold a job. And a lot of the people, like I said, the spectrum. So jobs are very important for our people on the spectrum. Housing is also a very important thing for people on the spectrum when it comes to, when we want them to become independent people. So when and it's amazing because a person with autism can have a superior IQ or get straight A's, yet can't tie their own shoe. They don't have the dexterity. They can draw perspective at age 4, but then can't tell you their name. So it's a very complex and confusing and very difficult disability, but to navigate the system has become even more difficult. So, you know, let's just imagine you're going to take a trip, and you might see a travel agent. It's a trip of a lifetime, right? You're going to see a travel agent. You're going to create an itinerary and do some research probably. You'll probably take a map, and once you get there, you might hire a guide. Now, let's take that trip into autism. And now you've seen your doctor or your psychologist or your special education teacher. You now have a diagnosis. You go home and you read everything on the internet. You read every book. You talk to everybody you know and get as much information as you can. But then you all of a sudden find out there's no map available. And when you get there, it's very difficult to hire a guide, much less have enough money to hire the guide yourself. I mean, because there aren't services available. We're not asking for anything right now. This is a non-fiscal note. Just create a task force. People are eager to serve on the task force because, not because of their own personal agendas, but because they know that this is an issue that we need to address now. We can't wait another year. And I tell you, the state really would be doing not only people with autism and people with families with autism, but they'd be doing every taxpayer a disservice because we want to make sure that these people get intervention and get the services they need early enough, whether they be private or public sector services. We want to make sure that everybody gets their services so that once the people reach an adult age, they're able to take care of themselves and not become a further financial burden to the state. So with that, you know, it's not going away. We just now know what we're looking at with those disability switching, like I said at the beginning. So I really encourage that every 21 minutes another child is diagnosed with autism. I haven't done the math to see what that's going to be in a year. So if Minnesota chooses not to do this now and puts it off, it's not doing anyone any good. So please support this task force.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Flowers. Oh,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank the press for coming up. I know from Rochester for Brad, and I think you're from here.
I'm from the West Suburbs.
Yeah, we appreciate you being here. And for members who don't know, this was House File 1811 for the Minnesota Autism Task Force. And last year, the Senate had gone through a resolution, I think, and created their task force, and the House didn't really have a mechanism to get ours going. So this year, the idea is you get both the House and the Senate together and even explore the issues further and try to come up with some sort of a map or a plan. So I hope members can support that.
Okay. Well, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you,
Chair Helen. Penny Needham. And apparently she's not here, so Jim Meffert, help. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jim Meffert Nelson, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Optometric Association. Now that Mr. Renner left the room, I'd like to echo his comments, and also while Representative Keithson and Scott Waltz aren't here. Both dangerous. I would like to echo many of the comments that Mr. Renner mentioned, many of the impacts of rate cuts and the provider tax and the access fund impact our doctors the same that they do doctors in the medical community. Virtually all of our optometrists are providers in the public health plans. We have always been committed to helping all Minnesotans. We understand the importance of clear vision and healthy eyes to this particular population and trying to move them to become taxing citizens or folks who have good jobs and don't need these services. That's a critical component. We've always understood that. The state's always understood that. We thank you for that. Maintaining that commitment is increasingly difficult with the provider rates, as mentioned earlier, that are from 1989, the lack of increases, proposals to cut those rates, funds shifted away from the access fund, more difficulty on the private side in shifting those costs around also. There's more pressure on the private side to actually decrease costs and to maintain. So that combination of increasing reimbursement rates on the private end and increasing costs is making that more difficult, and our members are trying to find ways to make sure that we can stay within the program. There are a couple of very specific things that I would like to mention. First of all, thank you for maintaining the integrity of the Access Fund and making sure that those dollars are used to provide healthcare services. That's a critical component for our members, and something I hear from them virtually every day. We would like to see, under the definition of primary care consideration giving, to adding codes 92014, 92015, 92004, and 92005. Those are comprehensive eye exam codes. For many folks, getting in and getting their eyes examined under these codes are their only entree into the healthcare services, and many issues such as good nutrition and healthy lifestyle and smoking and all of those things are discussed with those patients by optometrists and ophthalmologists throughout the state on a daily basis. And those are, like I reiterated before, maintaining healthy eyes and clear vision is critically important to this population. And we would like to discuss consideration of adding those particular codes to those services also. Under the both MA and GAMC programs, and that particular definition was on page 103, we would like to thank you for restoring the ability to collect copays under the MA program, as I read page 90. That will help to mitigate some of the cuts that are being proposed also, which I think is probably part of your rationale for doing that. Even a $3 copay, which comes to 10% of the current reimbursement rate for an eye exam, is very important, particularly to those practices that have a larger percentage of patients in public programs, and they do collect that. And that's a very important thing. And that cut this year that happened January 1st, that inability to collect that copay, was very difficult to take for a lot of those practices. So thank you for restoring that also. I would like to draw your attention also on page 108 to the similar language for the General Assistance Medical Care Program. There is language that was in effect prior to January 1st that put a $25 copay on eyeglasses. The overall reimbursement rate for eyeglasses under GAMC is $27.90. The removal of the copay made the total reimbursement rate for eyeglasses under GAMC $2.90. That has been very difficult for us to figure out how to work within that particular program. And again, that didn't have a fiscal impact on the state, as I read it. It was actually a copay collection for that particular population. We've been working with DHS to try and come up with creative solutions to try and fix this. They are hamstrung by the language also. We would ask that you consider perhaps restoring that particular copay, of the ability to collect that on page 108. Like I said, we are working with DHS to try and come up with solutions of bulk purchasing, perhaps even with our neighbors to the east, other ways of delivering these kinds of services. But that actually offers, putting that language back in, helps us try and figure out some of those solutions. We look forward also, as I mentioned in a letter that I wrote to the chair last week in regard to this, looking for other creative solutions for trying to serve these populations, strengthening the safety net clinics. We're working with many of those clinics to try and increase the number of eye care services that are provided in those locations to offset some of the pressure that's put on private clinics in those areas for the delivery system, which allows us to maximize outside funds and pool resources together to serve these populations is a solution that we need to keep looking at and need to consider strongly as we try and figure out how to get out of this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Mr. Nelson? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify? Well, we now have a quorum. So I'll call the meeting to order and announce that we're going to recess until 1 o'clock, and the pages will lock the room so you can leave your stuff here. And the DFL members should be bring their lunch to room 500 south, about 12. But we will be back here at 1 o'clock, so the meeting is now in recess. I'm going to call the meeting back to order, and if everybody would just sit down, we will have people pass out the amendments to you so you don't have to attack each other to get them. And so we still have before us the omnibus bill, and it's the delete all amendment, which was the 090461 amendment, or delete all, and so I'm open to having people ask questions if they have questions about the bill, or then we can move to we have a number of amendments. So, Representative Abrams.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and since the staff is all here and they've been studying for this, could they just kind of quickly go through by section what the repealers are? And I don't, if they're just technical, I don't need to have them read to me, but just what the theme of them is at least, so we can have that on the record. And I didn't look up all the parts for repealing. Maybe just start in Article 1.
Okay, good.
Wind our way through.
Some of the staff people just go through the repealers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, in Article 1, the licensing article, there are two repealers. The first one repeals a section of statute related to increasing the adult capacity to 5 persons. That's being changed because we're changing the requirement for the number of people. There's also a repealer of Minnesota rules, and that is the requirement that household members and caregivers be free from communicable disease.
Is that right?
That's right.
Can you please speak up a little bit? I can't. Sorry.
Sorry. The second repealer is Minnesota rules requirement that household members and caregivers be free from communicable diseases in facilities that provide in-home care.
Is that technical? Mr. Chair? Just a minute. It seems like an amusing thing to repeal. We want them to be okay if they're sick or something? Is that, did that come from the department? Was that in my bill?
No, it's not. That is the section of House File 1110, Representative Keating's bill.
Oh, okay.
To leave the mandate on.
Or the mandate. Thanks.
Mr. Chair and members, the repealer in Article 2 repeals GRH Community Living Adjustment and MSIP Consolidated Fund Performance Based Funds, and then Minnesota rules related to some recoupment of overpayments and emergency assistance due to the consolidation of emergency assistance programs.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, in Article 3, there are no repealers. In Article 4, state-operated services. The repealers relate to procedures for payment of care and treatment, and that's what this article deals with.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, in Article 5, that's the Health Department article, the first set of repealers is all from, I think it's Representative Murphy's adoption bill, so it's dealing with birth records. And then the second repealer is in 62U, and that's the requirement that MDH design an essential benefit set, and instead the bill, it was in the governor's bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, there's one repealer in Article 6. This is the repealer of the requirement that renew notices for the state health care programs be sent out 60 and 90 days prior to renewal.
Mr. Chair, there are no repealers in Article 7.
There are no repealers in Article 8.
Mr. Chair, in Article 9, there are repealers related to the redesign and recodification of PCA services, and also a repealer of the Medicare maximization program.
Mr. Chair, in Article 10, it's all new language, so there are no repealers.
Anything else? Representative Abler.
Well, I have a bunch more questions. I'll just ask somebody else if they want to go, and then I'll ask some other questions.
Any other questions right now?
Don't see any. Should be a short meeting.
We can only hope.
let's see. I said some notes here. I don't know who even to ask. On page 225, I left my glasses there on the way. Determination, the certified assessors, is that part of that compass thing, or is that another piece? It's in Article 9.
Could somebody from the department come down?
I just couldn't figure out what that was. Just the certified assessors. That's the section I mean. Or staff, I thought, you know. Well, I meant to be a short answer, but
tell me down on that.
Oh, good, yeah. Hate to have her come for nothing, you know.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm sorry, my name is Alex Vitalik, Mr. Chair and members. I didn't hear the whole thing.
Oh, on page 225, do you have a copy of the bill in front of you? Doing well. That certified assessor's business, is that related to the Compass thing we've been talking about, or is that another kind of certified assessor?
This is related to Compass.
Okay, so that's got it in the bill then. And you spent the money? Okay, and to that point, it's a good investment, I think, and I'm glad you found the money. Ms. Bartolik, I was chatting with some of your other staff, and they're of the opinion that if we evaluated all the people on every waiver in the state, that they were all perfectly placed there, and there is nobody wrongly, inappropriately placed there. It seems to me that that can't be true just because of how life is, that somebody would inadvertently be in. And I thought there'd be a savings that you would take for this in people who would be now even more accurately placed in programs, so that the line of eligibility would be a bright line, which I see as the strength of this program. Do you think that nobody will be found to be inadvertently placed in a setting because of this work?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, because there is an annual assessment, there often are times where people's needs have changed, their services need to change. There have been times when people no longer meet the eligibility requirements for the waiver. So I think over the course of time, we typically will see some changes in the program. We hope that there will be some good consideration about alternatives, but we have no information to suggest that people are inappropriately being served now.
Representative Abler. Well, thanks, it's not meant to be a criticism. I just was looking for savings where we can find them. And, it occurs to me that across the state that 84 units or whatever are doing these evaluations, that there would be a kind of a bell curve of like top performers that are like totally accurate for what you would believe to be correct, and some that people just are, well, there's a little, you know, there's certainly, I don't know what the worst county is, but there has to be the worst one and there's the best one. Anoka is the best one, I think I knew that answer, but there has to be the lower super, you know, that just aren't quite accurate, you know, just as they go on, I just keep it in the back of your mind, you might find some money there, even in, I know that we were told by one of your peers that there's an art to fiscal noting. And I think in your assumptions that you would find at least a few people that might be, you know, outplaced some waivers. So that's my only thought there.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, we will look at that. One of the questions about savings is typically if somebody was no longer eligible, the county would be able to serve someone else that wouldn't actually be a saving. But if there are people that could use different levels of services on a reassessment, it would give them some resources to use elsewhere. Yeah. Unless we were to have a different way of
managing the dollars.
And Representative Abler, you need to remember this is Minnesota and all the counties are above average.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Even Lake Wobegon County, where's that $7? But then just but if we, that's a good point. But if we, at some point, I know we're in the bill, we're limiting enrollment. If we somehow froze who's in, and nobody got new in was allowed in, if we allowed it to attrit, there would be some savings. Just a thought. I mean, I'm thinking more not for this bill, but there's a, maybe another, when we get to Constance, the target might be different, and we might wish we had that money. Thank you. That's my question.
Okay.
Another question.
Next question.
And this is my last one to the bill. The section on Article 10, that steering committee and all that county stuff, is that the county consolidation bill that's just put in here that the way it left the committee? Or is it the way it left, the latest version of it?
Representative Chief. Mr. Chair, it's different than even the last version that came out of. Where do we hear it? Out of Pulaski's, Representative Pulaski's committee.
And just in terms of...
And it's generally the same in terms of the county redesign piece, but we've added language on performance outcome reforms from Representative Loeffler's bill.
All right. And so my question is more procedural than content. And so is it going to be carried in the omnibus, and that's where the work will happen on this, do you think, Representative Thiessen?
Representative Thiessen. Because they cost money, yes.
Okay.
It costs, what, $350,000?
Yep. Awesome. All right. Thank you. Those are my questions for the bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay, are there other questions? We have some amendments here.
They're all good ones, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
I don't mean to monopolize the show, although I don't mind it. So I won't call it. And these are, and I want to thank the chair for putting a couple of things in the bill already. And some of these have been working in process, and some weren't already, and some I thought we should take separately. And I don't know exactly how many there are, but there's a short handful. And my intention, Mr. Chair, is to offer them for this discussion and then not to vote on them today. And so I know we, if that's right, if you don't mind me not taking a vote, I'll do it that way, if that would be okay with you. If we can talk about the A1-1 amendment, which is sort of what we talked about with Ms. Vartolik. And this is permissive. And in the A1-1 amendment, the county would create a panel, and it'd be the social... The thing is, it'd be a pretty enlightened panel, highly trained, and part of the challenge about Thomas, it's a year and a half to get that ramped up. And I still believe that if Ms. Bartolik would review everybody in a PCA program or a waiver program, she would ask, how do they get into a waiver? And I'm not trying to get rid of anybody who hasn't met the criteria. But as we have to turn people away, I want to turn away those with the lowest amount of needs who, so we can keep room for the people with the highest amount of needs. And this would simply say that this is permissive, and a county would be allowed to set up a little board of the social service director or designee, county commissioner, and then a social worker to review the eligibility. And I would think that in terms of practicality, that they wouldn't have to look very far at some of the people who are on waivers to tell us they certainly qualify for a waiver. The question might come later as to what services they might need. I want to remind members that there is no best practices list of services for people who meet a certain demographic in those waivers. And so this is meant to be helpful to counties. It's permissive. And in a time when we're trying to relieve, trying to maximize the services going to the people with the highest needs and even the most middle needs, this would be something productive. So that's my thought, and I appreciate people's reactions to it now if they have any.
Representative Abel is going to have a number of these, and if people want to comment on them, just raise your hand and I'll give you a call. Some of these may be presented in the Finance Committee Thursday, I believe.
And, Mr. Chair, it's my intention by offering them now that there'll be some chance to vet them. And there's some of these I've been talking to people in the hallways about, and so this is one of those ideas. So, especially if people have concerns about it, I'd like to hear those. That would be helpful to me.
Chair, Representative Abler, I want to move on to the next.
I'd like to withdraw that amendment now, if I could, Mr. Chair. And I have no order. I just, there's the A9 in my pile next.
So, Representative Abler.
I'll move the A9 amendment.
Move the A9 amendment.
For discussion. If there's any money to be found in the healthcare system, it's in the providers who are the highest utilizers compared to their peer group. And I've had many discussions with some people on the committee and people in the hallway about finding ways to identify these highest utilizing practitioners, be they chiropractors, medical doctors, not nurse practitioners, of course, but anyway. But in every profession, there's a bell curve. Not just even the competence level, but how much they spend per person per unit of time. And if you see this individual who's at the top of the bell curve, the staff knows that you're going to get a lot of tests, you're going to have an extra knee done, you're going to have another bypass, and you get more adjustments, and you get more of everything that that person does. And I'm not even questioning their motives, but I do want to help identify these folks and either remediate them by moving them down to be in the top 20% or so, or not have them be in our network. All the health reforms we've been doing all along have been chasing these individuals who, just for one reason or another, find themselves always in the top tier of their professional status. And what this does, it asks the Health Services Policy Committee to look at this in the state programs, in PMAP, Minnesota Care, et cetera, and see how to, this is just a placeholder, frankly. But if this would just go forward as it is, they would report back to how we might do some work on this. Currently, DHS has no capacity through all their mountains of data to track anything about this information. The people who do have the capacity are especially the bigger health plans. And they know who these providers are. And in a time when we are looking at retrenching our budget in the $6 billion range and no bottom in sight, especially in the state programs, it seems like it's something that we don't want to encourage they're called inefficient by some. The word generous, I don't know, but there's people that are doing care that is 80% above what all their peers vote on. You can't get any doctor group to agree 80% on anything, except just about like the legislature. But they agree by their practice styles that was enough money to spend on this patient group over the course of that period of time. And the more homogenous, the better. This is meant to be hospitalists, you know, working in a metro, hospitalists in the rural, and you know, single provider chiropractors, single whatever. So the more homogenous, the better. And I want to remind people, as all these health factors come in, when we do our data work, we're collecting data without any quality indicators as part of the health reform. Because I don't report data quality when I turn in my information. I just report cost and so on. So this is meant to be a help. And it's novel to this committee, but it's not novel to many people in the audience. And so I'll stand for questions about that.
Questions? Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's an intriguing concept. But just to clarify, your intention here is that for the same outcome, there are those who utilize more in maybe tests and procedures and numerous things, but for the same outcome, utilize and many times cost more as far as diagnostic tests and a variety of other things. So you're not talking about, you want the same good outcome as is accomplished by an average use of kind of these services. Is that correct?
Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Exactly. And in fact, as I talked to some of the plans, some of these high utilizers actually have poor outcomes because they do unnecessary procedures. If you know me, I'm all about good outcomes. And the money to me is actually secondary. But the money now becomes the leverage problem we have to even having preserving some care at all for people. So it's all about good outcomes, primary, and then an 80%, that's why I picked that high number in my head as that number. So, yeah, exactly. We agree.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman Hetley. I think the idea of getting a good outcome and costing us less is just the kind of ideas we need right now, as I think we all certainly want those good outcomes. But if we can spend a little less getting there, we can serve more people.
You're right, and I don't think you were here to hear my story last year. But I had a rotator cuff problem, and I went to my physician, who then referred me to the orthopedic guy, and he showed me the x-rays, and then he said, we can't tell if the rotator cuff is torn unless we do an MRI. And but then he said, but he says that costs $2,500, and 85% of the people respond to cortisone injections, so why don't we try that first? And, you know, 3 days later it was perfect. But he cost his clinic $2,500 because he could have ordered that test. Any insurance company would have paid for it. So how do we get a reward system that rewards someone like him for doing what's right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, Mr. Chairman, this amendment is that kind of possibility that might lay the groundwork for collecting the data that would help to do just that.
Representative Abler. Representative Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Abler, Representative Abler, for bringing this and some of these other ideas forward. There's some really good material here. I was just wondering, since you've been working at Chicken Away Lobbies for a long time, Representative Abler, and this is not meant as a criticism, I was asking for clarification so we could move forward working on this, because I'd love to work with you on this one. Has this one been attempted in previous years, or was there some significant obstacle to moving this forward? Because I don't recall seeing this before in the last 3 years, but it sounds like you've been thinking about it for a while. Is there some reason we weren't taking this up earlier?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn. Not the specific idea, but this is actually what HMOs were supposed to do when they first came around. And part of this, there's two fallacies to the HMO model of the early ones, not the current ones. I see glaring from the audience, but they're wonderful now. Anyway, but at least they've come a long ways, and there was they treated all the doctors the same. And so your middle provider, who was doing perfect cost work, was treated with the same level of scrutiny and as the high-end providers. And then when they would do their management, they would set a target, say 80%. That became the new 100. And then they would try to lower them to 100 to 80. And so it was very painful, and the cost, the quality declined markedly. Which is why I'm not the king, I'm not even a prince, but if I had some power, I would say 80% is the new norm per capita, per unit of time, a year or something. And then you could inflate that. And then allow these other people, not to kick them out, but say, we're playing ball under 80% here. Tell us why you need to spend so much money. And some of those are truly outliers because they have truly complex cases, but most of them just spend more money. They're high in everything. They're high in auto, they're high in work comp, they're high in medical assistance. And the difference isn't the rates that they charge. It's the amount of service they provide at the same rate. And so in medical assistance, you know, those costs are all, the charges are below what they cost. But if you do a bunch of them, you can make some money. So that's the idea. And it's meant to be a placeholder. Any advice people want to offer to this is welcome.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, I'm not quite sure I understand the placeholder reference at this point in our process. Are you saying that you're hoping Representative Huntley will adopt this in his amendment on Thursday, and then you're continuing to work on this in the next 3 weeks as we move to conference committee? What are you referencing so that we might be helpful to you there?
Well, I'll put my cards on the table, and it wasn't meant to be not that. I hope that this is in the finance amendment as it stands, or with some tweaks up in the May review kind of category. I'm very concerned about the cliff that we're going to face on January 1 of 2011, which is going to be a massive cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And this could be put into place in PMAP and medical assistance, in the PMAP, not in fee-for-service, they don't have that capacity, but if the PMAP providers and the Minnesota care providers could at some point chat with the department about who some of these providers are, then this could actually be put in as a saver, as a cost savings device, as we go forward into the conference season. And that's what I mean by a placeholder. At least if the idea is out there, people know to be aware of it. It's just on the same order as Senator Berglund's Tier 4 people not being allowed to practice in the, or something in the, mm-hmm. She has something on in this same genre. which actually saves money. This is right now, you have a target to hit, you've already achieved it, and this is not meant to generate a penny of savings until it's changed into a different form.
Okay, Representative Abler, do you want to move on to the next one?
Sure. And I appreciate the discussion about this. The next one, I withdraw the A9 amendment. If I could move now to the A11 amendment.
Representative Abler moves the A11 amendment.
And then maybe also the A17 simultaneously. Well, there's an amendment to the amendment, kind of. I don't want to do any amending, but...
I don't have an A17.
Oh, was that passed out?
No, we don't have it.
Oh, it's okay. And however you want to do it, and
well, I'll just talk about A11 first.
This is my birth center project, and I've worked with Representative Root on this, and she does not necessarily endorse this, but I've been talking to her and other members about this, so I don't want to say what people don't agree to, but there's four elements. We had quite a good discussion about that, and this has four elements. One on the first subdivision is that the Commissioner of Health has to establish a basket of care for obstetrics. And what I was concerned about in the these baskets business is that it's hard to come up with a good basket with people who are divergent in their practice patterns. And so in the process, they came up with a prenatal package, but there is no obstetric package. And in talking to the Department of Health, they were concerned about that, and I said, well, let's just make them go work on a real package. And so this tells them to go back and keep working on it. I understand there's no fiscal cost for that because they're already tooled up to do that, so they have to have some more meetings and accomplish that. The second part, and there's an amendment to that, I think. The department is still working on this with me. They keep adding ways to make it better. The second has to do with creating a blended rate for birth, both by provider and by facility. And I'm especially interested in the provider rate because we have heard about hospital C-sections ranging from 16% to 40%. And Representative, Mr. Chair, you and I agree they should both be under 10 as a target. And so if we, and I don't think money motivates providers very much as some people do, but if you get what you pay for sometimes. And so if we create a blended rate that pays the provider less than it would be for a C-section and more than he would get for an uncomplicated regular birth, that'll move people down the continuum and reduce costs and improve quality. We had quite a hearing about that. And I thought the sense of the committee was that we liked that direction. So that's what that is about. The third part is quality measurement. The third thing has to do with some quality to try to help people know what's the difference in a 16% C-section hospital and a 40% C-section hospital. What do they do differently, and how do we drive people down lower? And the fourth is the birthing center study, where the commissioner or whoever would sit down with some people who the objection to the birthing center was that standards of care and what would it look like, and this would they'd sit down and would come up with a proposal for us to act on for next session. They would do this by October, I think, January. And that's the amendment. And the A17 amendment is a better version of the payment rate that the department suggested language of. And I think just to keep it clean, I won't even amend this in. But this is language. It's been a work in progress since we had our hearing. Still a work in progress. And so I present this as my current level of my work, and I would hope people would look at it and offer advice. But I think that there's savings to be had in this version. I believe it holds harmless the people who are getting the birth, to be women, I guess, and the families. and in my interest in all this is to focus on who gets the service and deliver our services more efficiently, effectively, and targeted to what we want out for outcomes. And if some of these, this is one thing that would actually save some money and leave every birth still being supported in a good birth. So I'll stand
for the newer members of the committee, in last year's reform bill, which grew out of the governor's transformation task force, one of the things that was in there was what we call baskets of care. And one of the problems of healthcare services, you can't find out what anything costs And this was to set up something like, you know, prenatal care plus the delivery. And this is what this hospital and doctor charged for that, and so that you would know what the cost would be. Currently, it's practically impossible to find out what something's going to cost beforehand. And so the idea of baskets of care then is to inform the public about what certain things are likely to cost and have providers actually tell you what they're going to cost. And currently, that's very difficult to find out. So, Representative Abler, any other questions on the on that item? Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize, we just came from the tax committee, so my head's kind of spinning. I'm freezing over here. I'm very tired, and my knee just got smashed into the table, so my head's kind of spinning. I still smile. It's like,
fortunately, you have a nurse next to you.
No. Her head is spinning too, though. She is in taxes with me. And I just want to say, Representative Abler, I appreciate it. I know we've both been, we've had some discussions this session about this particular issue. I have some concerns. I'm not even sure I can articulate exactly what those are right now, and I apologize for that. It's the one thing I'm going to point out, and I don't know if your amendment does this, if we're adopting it or not, but putting a particular rate in statute. I have some concerns about doing that. The other thing, I have to make a comment about C-sections, and clearly we have concerns about the high rates of C-sections, but I work with a number of providers, and there certainly has been a dramatic improvement over the years about what we've seen happen with C-sections. I think, I really do believe that the people that I work with do that as a last resort, and it's their best, in their best medical judgment that that type of birth that has to occur. So I want to put that out there because I think sometimes that gets missed. But I do think there are some people who would like to maybe make some comments because you did ask for some public input. So I think that would be a good idea.
And Mr. Chair, just to the one part, the amendment actually takes the fee out, and it lets the commissioner establish it. So that's a good consideration. Thanks for the comment.
Mr. Renner. Mr. Chair, members, Dave Renner, Minnesota Medical Association. We have just seen this as well, so we're trying to go through this. As the Chair has done, you reminded the group that the basket of care work groups are still working. They're still in the process of developing their definitions of what's in or out of those baskets, and obstetric delivery is part of that discussion. How it will end up, we don't know. We would strongly encourage you to let that process continue to work and then come back with the recommendations on that. There seems to be some conflicting language in the bill in the sense that you ask that the basket of care include not only delivery and related inpatient hospital services but also prenatal care, but in the A-17 amendment you talk about setting a price just related to delivery, labor delivery and a part of postpartum care. So there's some conflicting language there as well. We would share the concern of putting a stat in the statute what the rate should be. And then on the issues of birthing centers, we have tried to work with this committee and Representative Rude to try to come up with the language on birthing centers and the concept. If we want to move on birthing centers, we would strongly encourage you to move in that direction for the purpose of ensuring quality and safety as opposed to using birthing centers as a cost-saving mechanism necessarily. Those are our initial comments on the amendment.
Any questions for Mr. Renner? Standing so, Ms. Stout from the Nurses Association.
Mr. Chair, on behalf of the Hospital Association, I want to express our concerns as well. Concerned about the facility reimbursement rates being put into statute. I think that our concern is that the system that we have right now is a cost-based system. The state looks at the actual cost of care and calculates for each hospital how much they're going to reimburse. And when we rebase that system works, and obviously we're a little bit behind on rebasing, but to begin to go down a path where we start pulling out particular services and putting the actual rate in statute is going to set us down a really tricky path. For one thing, whenever we rebase, we'll have to go back to the statute and try to update that particular rate. And it also sends us down a path where certain items are based on cost and others are based on a statutory rate. I think it's going to be very confusing, and we kind of think you have to choose one path or another, not take both paths simultaneously. A cost-based system is worse when we rebase, and we would just as soon stay on that path. There are certainly other ways that you can reimburse hospitals, but I think it takes a lot more thought than to try to do it in the form of an amendment like this. So we would prefer that you not do the reimbursement, setting the reimbursement in statute at this time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Aber.
Maybe I should have done the amendment to the amendment. Let me just help people understand with how this would track. And I'll just, I don't know if I want to clutter up the minutes. If I amend my amendment, would that cause any harm?
Sure.
Okay. Sure it would cause harm or sure it's okay? On the A11 amendment, if I delete line 3.9 to 3.17 and then insert the language on the A17 amendment, we've talked about this a number of times and I even said it wrong. What this will do, it makes it only a provider rate and doesn't do anything to the facility, which is what I was preferring in my discussions with the department. And actually it fits Ms. Stout's concerns and it also fits the statutory concerns. And so, if people are clear about that. And then the amendment, so on the A11 amendment, we would, I would move to delete lines 3.9 to 3.17 and insert lines 1.3 to 1.9 of the A17 amendment.
So Representative Abler moves on the A11 amendment on page 3, delete 3.9 to 3.17 and insert the language from the A17 amendment.
I probably just could incorporate that, couldn't I? I'll just incorporate that.
Okay, so he incorporates that into his amendment, and Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, I see that's now complete, but Mr. Renner raised the issue that your A17, which is now part of this A11, does not address the issue of the prenatal. You were trying to do the overall package, and even on the provider professional side, I think you would want to include the prenatal, so I'm a little confused about what you're trying to do here.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Abler,
what I was trying to do today is, actually it's appropriate, it's not being voted on. It's kind of helpful, but until these things get put out in a form, then people don't know what they're looking at. We had a very good hearing a month ago or whenever it was in that evening about the birth center stuff, and there was a lot of interest. And so then what's practical? And actually there are concerns, and so this puts in some words a version that we can actually work on and maybe take to the process if people are in agreement. To Mr. Renner's discussions about the birthing center part, I agree, which is why it's a review and a study to come back with recommendations from all the people who care about this. So I think does that make sense? Does that answer your question at all? And I don't know the answer about the prenatal part, if we want to put that as part of the rate. And that could be something that would be an amendment you and I could work on together, kind of out about it as we review this. But I'm looking for advice on this. Mm-hmm. This is definitely a work in progress.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and Representative Abler. I think, you know, in the vein of advice, I think there is some reconciliation to be done between the idea that the Department of Health would continue to work on a basket of care, and inherent in that is a rate, and then asking the commissioner to set a rate for obstetrical care. So I don't know if we need to be more explicit about those two entities needing to work together as this goes forward, but just in terms of advice, I think there's some conflict embedded in the language as it's drafted right now.
Yes, and Mr. Graber. To that point, let me just help. It's the Commissioner of Health working on the baskets, and the Commissioner of Human Services paying for a birth. And the baskets of care, I think, are optional for people to do. Those are just the rate that they would it's a collection of services that people would agree then they would bid them, so we'd know we're getting these many things. And at some point they might converge. But in the meantime, the worlds are too, they're moving in parallel tracks. This is a way, and frankly, this is a way to try to save some money while sacrificing no quality in the short run, especially as we face the January 11 cliff. So I'm happy to chat with all of you about this, and that's why I'm kind of glad we're not going to vote on it yet. And I think that maybe the amendment's not so bad, just being the delivery portion, and then, you know, if we want to try to work on prenatal, we could probably go after that too. But this was meant to be about C-sections in particular, and pushing women, rewarding the system for giving people more conservative options and less intervention and frankly less postpartum harm and all that. So,
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two comments in regards to this. One was to the payment rate for births in the Section 36. The big thing as far as including prenatal is usually done in a clinic setting, whereas all the other professional services, labor, delivery, antepartum, and postpartum is usually done within the hospital setting as part of the actual birth. So I think it's appropriate here to not include prenatal in that particular payment rate for birth, because you have two very different entities that are dealing with the patient in that regard and different focus. So I think leaving prenatal out there, in my opinion, seems appropriate. In regards to the study on the birthing center, I was really excited about that and thought it had just some really good things. And the main thing there is that the realization that having a baby is not a disease. It's not something, you know, it's a different thing. And it's especially written here in which births are planned to occur that are don't have complications or have other issues that are relatively that. Many times these kinds of centers can do an excellent job and give a really, really nice experience for people. The only question I had here, though, was I noticed that it said it's not in a hospital. It's not a hospital or in a hospital away from the mother's usual residence. Is it something that a hospital could own and could be next door? Or is it was your intention here to have it totally not be part of a hospital at all?
Actually, if you look at line 3.1, it says it's not a hospital. I wonder how that's meant to be just inclusive. A birthing center could be in a hospital. The idea of this study was about standards, for one. That's freestanding. But this could easily be, I think they should be exhaustive in considering all the options. So my fellow, Dr. Calvin, that came, actually liked the idea of a birthing center in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And then we talked about freestanding ones in the other bill that we had, and I thought they were both good ideas. So.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that is important. It's kind of similar to having an urgent care within a hospital. The idea is to meet the need, have good outcomes, but they don't always necessarily need a full-bore emergency room to do it, nor sometimes do all many healthy births can do very well in different kind of settings. If you kind of make that distinction, it makes it help to be, again, good outcomes, but sometimes the proximity to a higher level of need, it's nice to have that. So I just wanted to clarify, and maybe just a little bit of wordsmithing in regards to that to make it clear that it could be possibly within, if that was your intention.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, Representative Rude.
Mr. Chair, thank you. As the author of one of the birth center bills, you know, I worked pretty hard on that bill. I brought a lot of people, came together and put a lot of time and effort into that. I think we've reached a really nice place with that particular bill. It changed a little bit as it went through the process, and there continues to be concerns, but I think the discussion we're having now kind of reflects the complexity of this particular issue and trying to maybe move forward with this amendment. I have to just say I have concerns about that. But I also want to say, Representative Kiffmeyer, in prenatal care with the birth centers, it actually would probably be at the birth center, is my understanding anyway. Right now, and I could be wrong, maybe the plan room could correct me, I think hospitals get the facility fees that they when a birth occurs, but the prenatal care is billed as a package. So you get your prenatal care in the clinic that you deliver at the hospital. So the other thing is I think one of the plans has, they're in discussions right now about merging the provider rates. And I don't know if they want to speak to that, but I think there's actually some work being done out there on this particular issue. So I don't know if anybody wants
to. Mr. Renner, did you have a comment on this?
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on Representative Root's comments and respond to Representative Kissmeyer, in the private sector anyway, many times, if not all times, the payment that is paid to the professional is usually a global rate that includes the prenatal care and the delivery. So that's the reason why you raised that issue, because on one hand, we're asking that the basket of care be developed to come up with that whole global package, and that's how it's generally billed in the private sector. Here you're talking about a separate bill just for the other. The other issue I would just point out on the payment, if we were going to go down this direction, the whole issue of risk adjustment of some sort, which is always an issue that comes up, and then it would need to be somehow worked into this as well.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate your comments, Mr. Renner, in regards to that. And yes, often discussions, reimbursements or so on are more of that package altogether there. What I was referring to more was maybe a site payment kind of service, not necessarily a physician. So they can be together, and that, you're right, Representative, there is complexity to this. I certainly understand that. Thank you.
Okay, Representative, do you want to withdraw that one then?
I said a lot of fun. We could talk some more. I'd like to withdraw that.
So, Representative Ayler withdraws the A11 amendment as amended.
Just have another amendment.
Go ahead.
I feel like Mark Olson and I, that part I know. Is he in the audience? Right? Anyway, let's do the A8.
Representative Kiffmeyer is laughing very hard at that one.
A8. Anyway, so off the A8 amendment. And this is following up on the Elko County work that we remember they had that one about the self-insured or self-employed people. Current policy at DHS, I'm told, is that somebody is found to have misrepresented their income or underreported some income, that they simply do not qualify. They don't give them the program that they qualified for. Some of the magnitudes of money that's underreported, my county has discovered, are considerable, and they would like to report these to the Department of Revenue, but that's against policy. And this would simply allow them to report that to the Department of Revenue. That's the first part. And these people should be paying their taxes, seems to me. The second part, and then they would do whatever they would do. And the second thing is, in the same discussion, currently there's some people who are new to the country who are working as siding contractors, and they report their income. They work for cash, and they report their income as zero. They're getting more than zero. And so my county doesn't know what to do about that, and so they suggested that maybe if we could have the revenue and the DHS work together and decide that they should find out what they're really getting. And they would come back with some idea about how to report that, how that should be handled. That's what these are for, and that's my amendment.
Any discussion? Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Abler. I guess I just have two comments. I have a question and a comment. So for the Department of Revenue, for DHS to be able to speak to the Department of Revenue, that seems to be a better remedy than maybe the bill that we had before that set asset limits for folks who may be misrepresenting what they make out of self-employment. To me, that's kind of where I was looking to go, which is to say that if someone is not claiming to DHS, or is underclaiming to DHS what they're making versus what they're claiming to the Department of Revenue, that's a revenue issue, and that they should reconcile, and then we should figure out what they make and then adjust the overpayment or suspend them or prosecute them accordingly. So I kind of, in some instance, like this. If I look at it, I hope to look at it even closer. The second thing about the underreporting, I think that there are a lot of people who are owed to this country, who've been here a long time, that are doing this, that aren't reporting. And so I just don't think it's new people or new immigrants that are coming here who are not reporting their income if they're doing side jobs or their primary income is being paid by cash. So I want us to make sure that people do that all the time, and that we should be kind of trying to figure that out, but I don't want to point out new immigrants as just the group that does that.
Oh, yeah. Let me apologize. I didn't mean that at all, but this was just an ongoing challenge. They mentioned that as the latest challenge that they have a challenge to months. Every month they have the new challenge. I appreciate that. I'll be more careful to say it better. But thank you.
Okay, any other questions on the Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, I guess I do have a few concerns about this. I mean, in theory, you know, I mean, of course we want to make sure that only people who are entitled to benefits get them. I mean, that should pretty much go without saying. But what you've got here, and we are looking at 8-8, right? Am I on the right thing? Good. Okay. Well, the first part of it, the subdivision 29 part, the commissioner shall report to the Department of Revenue. A couple questions about that. First of all, the people that are screening for this stuff are mainly the counties, right? Not the Department of Human Services in the first instance. So I just kind of wonder why you're giving this to the commissioner and whether there would be any fiscal note created by this, you know, whether they have systems in place to do this. I guess where I'm kind of going with this is this solving a problem that, because right now we don't have appropriate systems? I mean, I thought we were doing all kinds of things to try to make sure that people are really eligible, and I guess I'm kind of missing something here. The other piece of it, the second paragraph on the amendment, it seems like you're just asking the commissioners to tell us how we can help to make sure that people are caught when they understate their income. And I mean, they're here all the time. Why do we have to put this in law? Why don't we just, when they're here testifying, we just ask them, you know? What should we be doing? I don't really get why we're going this route.
Mr.
Representative Abler.
Well, thanks. To the first part, I was just told by my county that they had that amendment that we took from them, by the way, is worth about $5 million in the tails. That can't go in effect until January 1 of 2011. It's considered a change in how they collect some information. But it's like $3 million a year, which is an interesting amount of money to accumulate from that one thing. But they tell me that when they discover somebody who's underreported, the DHS policy is to not do anything more than just disallow their program. And they aren't, like in this case, they wanted to look at the income, how do you pay a $600,000 house out of money that qualifies you for Minnesota Care. The answer is you don't. And so with that freedom, then they can make sure the money is free to serve people who need the program. And this here would also be, this was just a playful language, Representative Liebling. It was just scratched together in short notice after I was asking my county, what else can we do? And so I'm open to any language improvements you can make. The second part about the study, if I had an amendment with 6 points on how we shall track this revenue, they'd say, well, maybe they should go work on it and come back with a report. So the county's suggestion was if the department and the revenue could talk about how they might just even try to get their arms around this, not being discriminatory to any group, which I don't want to be, but also to make sure that the revenue that people are getting is realized. If I did that, if I didn't report my income from some side job, I would be in the paper, So that's all. Again, maybe it's lucky we're not voting on it today, but if you have any advice, it seems like this is a way improve our system.
You wish to withdraw that now?
I'm not still
Representative Liebling. Oh, Representative Liebling.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, not to belabor the point, but maybe Representative Abler, maybe what you want to do is make it submissive instead of the commissioner shall report. Maybe you want to say the commissioner may. If there's currently a barrier to doing that, I certainly don't have an objection to removing that barrier. But anyway, that would
Mr.
be my Chair,
maybe, I think I'll just change that now. This is meant to be a friendly piece. It's not meant to be going after anybody. Just to maybe do a policy shift at DHS that they would at least encourage, especially if it's a big amount of money. So
Representative Abler moves on the A8 amendment on line 1.6 that the shall be
change to a may.
And I'll incorporate
that. And you want to incorporate that. Okay, and Representative Slavik.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, we have in the new allowance program, this is something that Senator Clark has wanted, that kids wouldn't have to, right now parents have to fill out these lengthy applications to qualify, and she just wants revenue to run the report, and then we could see who qualified, and it wouldn't have to go through all the paperwork that way. It's not as easy as you might think. So I'm just saying, I think we're laying this aside or whatever. In the interim, you might want to talk with Senator Clark from St. Cloud, if you look into extensively how you get reports from revenue to qualify or disqualify people for child care and allowance programs. And she tells us that there will be a day when we'll be doing this for, in this case, qualifying, in your case, maybe disqualifying, but they're not quite there yet.
We've had enough fun at this one.
Okay, so Representative Abler withdraws the A8 amendment, and we're now on the last one, the A7.
That'll be the second last one.
Well, we have more?
Sorry. Just, how about the A12? Why don't somebody else come talk to us? Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A11 amendment, ask Mr. Regan to come down and chat with us quickly if somebody besides me talking.
We did the A11.
I mean, my glasses are on. A12. Oh, it's A12. A12.
Representative Abler moved the A12 amendment, and Ms. Regan, welcome back to the committee.
Ms. Chair, just have to, I got this at the request of Ms. Regan. I didn't write this one, so maybe you'll like this one. And there's a concern with some of the licensing fees, and Ms. Regan has a proposed solution.
Ms. Regan.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Mary Regan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, representing providers of treatment services for children and adolescents. As I testified this morning, there's a particular group of providers called group residential facilities that serve children who need placement for treatment purposes in group homes and residential treatment centers. And their licensing fees are scheduled to increase by over 1,000% over the next biennium. This amendment would allow the Department of Human Services to retain 5% of the federal dollars that these programs generate and use it to help mitigate the increase in licensing fees. So the department retains 5% in fiscal year 07. That was about $177,000. They returned most of that money to the counties using a formula based on their use of these programs, and they only kept around $4,000 of the $177,000. Since counties are the ones that are primarily paying the per diem for these programs, I think it makes more sense for this set aside to be used to offset the cost of licensing fees and help mitigate the increase for these providers. It will not eliminate the licensing fee increase. I believe for this group, the requirement is about $523,000 in increased fees. So the $177,000 would be just a partial offset. So they would still see an increase in licensing fees.
Representative Abler.
No, I'm sorry, I was waving it for a fee. So, Lionel, what do you think of that? Is that
okay?
That's the idea I'm bringing forward on behalf of Ms. Regan.
And then how many more do you have?
Two.
Representative Bunn has a question first.
Thank you. I expect we heard this in committee at one time, but could someone from the agency or could you address the reason why 1,000% occurred in one fell swoop and the increase in the fees? And also whether or not these fees reflect the cost of regulated facilities or is it more than just the cost?
Mr. Chair, I think this is coming from the governor's proposal, and basically, they want to switch over, so it's covering the cost. And so for some of these, the cost is we're not going to subsidize it anymore. That's why it goes up. But we're working on some other language to try to get at this issue as well. So I'll work with you, Jim, to figure this out. Representative Abler.
Yeah. It's okay. Well, I appreciate that. I thought it was a thoughtful idea, and since nobody else had any amendments, I thought we might as well spend some time talking about that. So I'd like to withdraw that now.
We withdraw the A-12 amendment.
Mr. I just want to have only one more, and that'd be the A-7. I'll pass on the A-2 for now.
A-7?
Yep. That just got passed out. There we go. I wanted to, you know, when you have a fireworks show, Mr. Chair. Is that passed out?
Yes.
At the end of a fireworks show, you know, have like the grand finale, you know, and people kind of look forward to it, and they think, and you remember grand finales from the past, and this is my licensed professional clinical counselor amendment, and I don't know, I guess if they helped get them licensed in the first place, I have some ownership of this group, but these are really nice people. And they've gone to school for 2 more years now, and they want to be able to serve people in Minnesota care programs and MA programs, and across the hinterlands of Minnesota, there's 30, I think, of these folks now that are close to getting their new credential, or they've got it. And the challenge has been to find the money to pay for these people's services. And so this is my latest version. This is probably my fifth effort at finding ways to pay. And so you can skip down to page 11. There's no need to read the first 10 pages. You've seen all those before. There's nothing new about the first 10 pages. I had a novel thought. I thought on line 11.29 that as I read the emails that come from these people, they say, if we can serve people, they'll stay out of the hospital and they maybe won't kill themselves, which I thought was a pretty high value. And it turns out that even all those cost money. If you avoid either of those outcomes, it's a money saver. And Mr. Zachel at the department said, well, we've been promised all these savings about not doing this stuff, and it's not saving the money. So I still like number A anyway. It says they have to consider hospitalizations that are avoided. We need to find about 100 grand a year is what it costs to do this. And so I still want to work on that some more. The second idea that occurred to me after talking to him was that if we conduct a review of the post-hospitalization review of people who are put in inpatient care over a mental health thing, just to kind of get an idea about why they're going in and did some get wrongly placed there, and can we get some best practices around that. Maybe the state will save money on hospitalizations that weren't necessary, and we'll learn something. That doesn't save any money in the front end, but that's kind of a reform. The final thing, which I know will make all the people happy, well, a couple anyway, is a number C on page 12.3. $23 million we get paid out to mental health professionals, and we need $100,000. And so I thought if we'd adjust the rate by about 0.3% of what they get, then they can help their comrades into the boat. And I believe this will save money. This whole amendment, if we put them in, we're going to have to spend the money. But if it says the commissioner may adjust the rate to make it neutral, to make these people into the network of healthcare providers. We had a working group probably 3 years ago now, with every licensed health provider, mental health provider that there was, looking at the licensed professional counselors. We upgraded the criteria to be an LPCC, a licensed professional clinical counselor, and based upon that, they went to school and they're in Mankato and elsewhere getting their credentials. We can't find 100 grand to pay these folks, and so, I'm not 0.3% in a time like this is the worst it could be, and I think if they actually go back and sharpen their pencil, maybe this is the way to get them paid for. So I offer the grand finale, and hopefully at some point we'll celebrate through fireworks that these people actually get included. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm done with all my amendments. I want to keep this one. I'll withdraw it, too.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your kindness.
We have one additional person that wishes to testify on the bill, Assistant Commissioner Osberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Brian Osberg. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Healthcare, the Department of Human Services. And on behalf of the department, I'd like to make a quick statement. So thank you for the opportunity to briefly comment on the division's omnibus bill. We've appreciated the engagement and communication with you and the staff as you developed this bill. As you know, your reduction target is much lower than the governor's target, but it's not clear how you will be able to manage cost pressures in the fastest growing portion of the state's budget. In particular, the different proposal uses $99 million to one-time funds from the federal stimulus bill to offset costs in GAMC. We need to better understand this funding source, but this temporary solution does not make the long-term changes needed in the structure of GAMC to curb funding growth in this area. The bill also maintains current eligibility levels even after the stimulus dollars are spent. With no long-term changes in eligibility, the state will be facing similar or more severe budget challenges in 2 years. So we want to talk to you more about what happens in the tails in this proposal. We'll continue to analyze the bill and provide our comments to you. We look forward to working with you on a budget solution that puts the state on a more sustainable path. Again, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to make that comment.
Representative Houston, can you just expand a little bit? Not a lot, I suppose, but but a little bit on the first comment you made about the $99 million
and
what the governor's alternative was.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Houston, yes, in terms of, we understand that $99 million is from the federal stimulus package, I believe from the education side of the package. And we believe that we need to reform the GAMC program independent of budget savings requirements. And as you know, what we do there is try to develop a new arrangement whereby we bring GAMC back into the fee-for-service arrangement, develop care coordination, and some incentives to make sure that we focus on primary care services and early intervention for our GAMC members. We think that's what has to happen for them to get better care. In the meantime, we do, it's true, we do have savings associated with that budget proposal in terms of the inpatient side of it. So that's what we need to talk to you more about, is how can we reform the GAMC program going forward, independent of targets before us.
Representative, Mr. Chair, I just made this question for you. Are we taking $99 million from the education stimulus money to pay for this bill?
It's not education stimulus money. There is, I'm not sure the exact amount, but there is a lump sum that comes to the state. The state can use it any way it chooses. When we got our first target, it was... I believe about $89 million. I think we got, and in the past week, the leadership gave us another $10 million. So there is one time money, but it's not education money.
And Mr. Chair or Mr. Osberg, the I think I appreciate you talking about the GAMC reform, but I'm glad that you actually mentioned at the end that you're actually, I think you're saving close to $100 million or more than that in reduction in services to people already on GAMC, which is essentially not provided. So I think you kind of phrased it very nicely, but I think we have to keep coming back to that point. But when you're talking to us about reform, which we'd be, I'm sure we'd love to engage you in that discussion, also understand that we think it's actually important in these times, especially with the economic pressures that a lot of these families are going through, or a lot of individuals, because they're GAMC, they're not families, but individuals are going through, that they actually have access to health care services. And I think the governor's proposal, when you're not talking about the cuts you're actually making to it, over $100 million in cuts, it presents a little bit of an unfair presentation to the committee. So I would just leave you with that. So if we're going to engage in the discussion, I think we have to engage in it fairly and transparently.
Commissioner, your real approach to GAMC is to eliminate the program as far as hospitals are concerned. We have at least two hospital systems in the metro area right now that are on the verge of bankruptcy. The governor's proposal would have simply accelerated the rate at which these two hospital systems head towards bankruptcy. The governor did not address problem of the people on GAMC. He just said, we're not going to deal with it anymore at the state level. We'll let the hospitals deal with it. And as far as eligibility is concerned, that's 113,000 people that the governor wanted to eliminate from health care coverage. Almost all of those are on Minnesota Care, which is fully funded and is not in deficit. And the governor wants to take the money that should have been spent on Minnesota Care and spend it elsewhere in the budget.
I don't think your reform for GAMC would work because it doesn't deal with the kind of population that is represented there, and I don't think that we ought to get rid of Minnesota Care. It's fully funded by the provider tax, and those 113,000 people need health care. Thank you for your testimony. We're now back to the bill, and if there's any discussion of the bill, go ahead. I don't see any, so I will renew my motion that House File, what is it? 1562 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
So the that bill is dealt with. Now we also have to deal with the minutes from the April 20th. What? Because we have just a couple of minutes of silence here, we'll be done. Representative Fritz moves the minutes of the April 20th meeting. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So we adopted the minutes.
Mr. Chair.
And I would like to...
Well, you just set a new record for passing a health on this site. Congratulations.
Thank you, Mr. Abler. And I would like to publicly thank our pages, Travis and Kim, who have worked. There they are. But they'll be back here tomorrow as we continue. And I would like to thank all the staff that helped put this bill together and worked many hours. As I always say, most legislators go home on weekends, and we leave our research staff here to do all the work while we're back home enjoying ourselves. So I want to thank them for their work. And and with that, the meeting is adjourned.